Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Comiskey Park, Chicago, the site of the most lucrative fight in the history of boxing.
It's September the 25th, 1962, and one of the most controversial heavyweight boxers ever has just entered the ring.
Pennsylvania, Sonny Liston.
The challenger, Charles Sonny Liston, is no stranger to the boos of the crowd. Cast as the bad man of boxing, Liston is one of the most formidable fighters in the history of the sport.
Bang, bang. It was like a trip hammer. The guy hit. Every time he hit, he broke something.
An illiterate who had spent time in jail, Liston's turbulent life was wrapped in rumor and contention, and trouble seemed to follow him around.
Sonny Liston was a badass fighter, an ex-con, a bully, and a thug. Run by organized crime.
At a time when the civil rights movement was shaking America, Liston was stereotyped as the threatening black man.
There was so much hatred aimed in his direction, and the use of horrible racial epithets was in play. Freely referring to Sonny Liston as a gorilla, as an animal, as a monkey.
The bad press that haunted Liston's life pursued him to the grave. His death was surrounded in mystery, and there were rumors of a mob hit or a drugs overdose. But in 1962, Liston already knew that he was the bad guy. Away from boxing, he was shy and vulnerable. But few were willing to see beyond the newspaper headlines, and Liston was left with no choice but to play the tough guy.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Cassius Marcellus Clay. He's young, he's handsome.
They know it.
He's a poet, a prophet, and many people believe he'll be the next heavyweight champion of the world.
In 1964, a challenger to Liston's title is announced. A brash young fighter who had fought and shouted his way to the top.
This is the fight that everyone has been clamoring for, and as of this minute, it is now official.
I'm the greatest. That's why I'm the biggest in all history, because I'm here.
Known as the Louisville Lip, no one other than himself gave Clay a chance against Liston.
Well, I draw a sellout crowd. I don't need nobody. They need me. You're lucky you're looking at me in person.
Clay, so you look the same when I get through with you.
Clay comes out to meet Liston, and Liston starts to retreat. If Liston goes back an inch farther, he'll end up in the ringside seat.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, July 29th, 2016. So I have been told. This is our third study session on Randy Roberts, Johnny Smith's Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship, between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. We are picking up on Chapter 4, In Cold Blood, the audio segment you heard at the beginning from the documentary film Sonny Liston, The Champ Nobody Wanted. Very interesting documentary that, once again, centers around white supremacy racism. But the huge fight between Sonny Liston, Muhammad Ali, he was Cassius Clay at the time, that is going to be building up in this week's section of the reading. Without further ado, we will get started. Context of White Supremacy, Blood Brothers, audio segment number one.
Chapter 4, In Cold Blood. Because a man doesn't throw a punch, doesn't mean he can't do so whenever he gets ready. Malcolm X. When Cassius Clay answered the telephone one day in early June 1962, he had no idea that the call would change his life. It was Sam Saxon, calling to invite him and his brother Rudy to Detroit for a black Muslim rally. Over the past year, Cassius had attended more Muslim meetings outside Miami, but he had not yet heard Elijah Muhammad preach in person. With more than 5 weeks until his next scheduled fight, Clay could afford to spend a weekend with Saxon. So Cassius eagerly accepted his invitation. And a few days later, Sam picked up the Clay brothers in Louisville and drove them to Detroit. There was someone very important Saxon wanted Cassius to meet. When they arrived on Sunday, June 10th, they stopped at a luncheonette crowded with black patrons. Sitting at a back table where he could watch the front door, surrounded by Muslim officers and an assortment of supplicants, Malcolm X noticed Sam Saxon, accompanied by two handsome, athletic men, walking straight toward his table. Malcolm could see that they were anxious to meet him. One of the brothers, a confident young man with the face of a matinee idol, pumped the minister's hand and announced, "I'm Cassius Clay," which he assumed said it all. For more than 2 years, Cassius had been repeating his name, usually adding that he was the greatest and the prettiest fighter who had ever laced on a pair of gloves. When Malcolm met the Clay brothers, however, he did not realize that one of them was famous. He had not followed boxing, bet on matches, or read the sports page since he left prison. "Up to that moment, I had never heard of him," he said later. "Ours were two entirely different worlds." They spoke only briefly, as Malcolm had only a few minutes to finish preparing his opening remarks for the rally. But Clay had already made an impression on him. There was something about the young fighter, some contagious quality, simply a likable, friendly, clean-cut, down-to-earth charm that intrigued Malcolm. He did not know it yet, but he would soon understand that there was a place for Cassius Clay in his world. In the early 1960s, as the civil rights movement intensified, so too did Malcolm's violent rhetoric. The Muslims, he claimed, lived by lex talionis. "We believed in a fair exchange," he said. "An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a head for a head, and a life for a life. If this is the price of freedom, we won't hesitate to pay the price." When anyone questioned the nation's willingness to retaliate, he replied that a Muslim was like a boxer in the ring, with his fist cocked, just waiting for the right opening. He warned, "You might see these Negroes who believe in nonviolence and mistake us for one of them and put your hands on us, thinking that we're going to turn the other cheek, and we'll put you to death, just like that." The time had arrived for the Muslims to punch back. On April 27, 1962, about 6 weeks before Cassius Clay met Malcolm X, a melee broke out between police officers and members of the nation's Los Angeles mosque. It all began when two black men standing behind the open trunk of a car were stopped by white policemen in a parking lot a few doors away from the mosque. As the officers frisked them, a crowd of angry Muslims gathered. In a matter of minutes, chaos erupted. Shots were fired, and the Muslims retreated for safety. Squad cars of backup officers rushed to the scene. Policemen raided the mosque and randomly struck black men with nightsticks. The next morning, the Los Angeles Times announced in bold print, "Muslims riot, cultist killed, policeman shot." When the gun smoke cleared, one Muslim, Ronald Stokes, the secretary of the mosque, was dead, another was paralyzed, and five others had been wounded. All but one of the policemen's bullets hit the Muslims in their backs. The LAPD booked 14 black men on suspicion of assault with intent to kill. The Times described the blazing gunfight like it was the shootout at the OK Corral. Beneath the newspaper headline was a picture of Stokes, handcuffed and lying face down in a pool of blood. When Malcolm heard the news, he wept for Stokes, whom he had known since 1960. Enraged, he swiftly buried his sadness and prepared for revenge. In Harlem, he confided to his assistant ministers that he planned to organize vigilantes. But Elijah Muhammad ordered him to stand down. "Brother, you don't go to war over a provocation," he told him. "They could kill a few of my followers, but I'm not going to go out and do something silly." Muhammad sent Raymond Sharif to Los Angeles, where the supreme captain of the Fruit ensured that there was no coordinated retaliation. Without authorization to retaliate, Malcolm instead escalated his rhetoric. On May 4th, a week after the shooting, Malcolm held a press conference in Los Angeles at the Statler Hilton Hotel and accused the police of murdering Stokes. "Seven innocent, unarmed black men were shot down in cold blood by Police Chief William Parker's Los Angeles City Police," he charged. He thought that Parker, who sometimes pronounced Negroes as Nigras, was guilty of filling his own men with hatred of the black community and spreading lies about the Muslims. In Los Angeles, Malcolm argued, blacks lived under a police state, just like the Jews in Nazi Germany. The following morning, Malcolm conducted Stokes's funeral at the two-story mosque, where more than 2,000 blacks packed the old stucco lodging hall. Although white journalists were barred from entering the building, black reporters told the Los Angeles Times that the minister delivered a moving tribute for the Muslims' fallen warrior. Outside the mosque, hundreds of mourners lined both sides of Broadway, watching the pallbearers carry Stokes's body in a gray casket. Some men bitterly complained about Elijah Muhammad's warning against revenge. Others were so angry that they renounced Muhammad and left the Los Angeles mosque altogether. If the black man was ever going to be truly free, they declared, he had to defend himself. Standing near the hearse, a tall, lean black man with a shaved head, dressed in a dark suit, faced a photographer from the Times. Fixing his gaze on the camera, he struck a militant pose, raising his fist in what would later become known as a Black Power salute. His clenched fist signified defiance, assertiveness, and liberation. The Times didn't identify the man by name, but in his silent rage for justice, his gesture spoke eloquently about a burgeoning movement that had no name. Muhammad sent word that the Muslims should head out into the street and begin the war with the devil. But it was not the kind of war his followers expected. They would fight the white man by exposing his crimes, letting the world know that he was the devil, by selling newspapers. Selling newspapers? The men could not believe what they had just heard. What were they going to do with the newspapers? Roll them up and swat armed policemen like flies? Edward 2X Sherrill, the captain of the mosque, exhorted, "I want all of you brothers to take at least 50 newspapers. Be sure you pay for them right now at the door." Malcolm shared the brothers' frustration with Muhammad's passivity. He was even more outraged when an all-white coroner's jury took less than 30 minutes to acquit the LAPD of killing an unarmed black man, claiming his death was justifiable homicide under lawful performance of duty and in self-defense. The police shooting radicalized the black community, galvanizing the movement toward greater militancy and confrontation. The Stokes case further elevated Malcolm into a national political figure. He began thinking of himself as a leader, a grassroots organizer, and a voice for the masses. He spoke less and less about Muhammad's religious teachings and more about politics and current events. Most importantly, the murder made him reconsider the nation's role in the larger struggle. Calling for wider racial unity that transcended religion and ideology, he urged blacks to come together against the common enemy. The events in Los Angeles deepened Malcolm's internal conflict within the nation. When Muhammad heard that Malcolm had called for greater cooperation with civil rights groups, he demanded that his minister return home. "Brother, stay where I put you because the civil rights organizations have no place to go," he said. Muhammad did not want him leading demonstrations, agitating authorities, or arousing greater attention from the FBI. The risk was too great. Malcolm was the nation's most prized asset, and Muhammad could not afford for him to go to jail or get himself killed. The Supreme Minister instructed him to play dead on everything. That was an order. Malcolm seethed. He felt like a tiger on a leash, reduced to nothing more than an empty roar. His critics complained that he sure talked a good game, but he never did anything. In Harlem, people saw him standing across the street from picketers, distancing himself from demonstrations. Sometimes he showed up at civil rights meetings, slouching in the back of the room, with his hat pulled low. Elijah's passive response to the assault on the Los Angeles mosque was an embarrassment. For years, he had been telling his followers that if they were attacked, they must be willing to sacrifice their lives in the name of Allah. Every mosque had captains, lieutenants, and soldiers in the fruit, preparing for the Battle of Armageddon. Now Muhammad ordered retreat, just as the battle was about to begin. "The messenger," Malcolm bitterly complained to his assistant ministers, "should have done more. People in the civil rights movement have been brutalized, and we haven't done anything to help them. Now we have our own brothers killed and maimed, and we still haven't done anything." FBI agents listening in on Muhammad's phone calls learned that he had become alarmed about his young minister's restlessness. He worried that there was no one who could control Malcolm, not even the messenger himself. During a phone call, Elijah warned Malcolm just before he hung up, "I hope Allah will keep you wise." On April 26, 1962, the FBI's Chicago office sent a report to J. Edgar Hoover offering valuable information that could be used to discredit Elijah Muhammad with his followers. Informants divulged that Muhammad had engaged in extramarital affairs with women who belonged to the nation. Of those, at least seven mistresses, most of them former secretaries, claimed that the messenger had fathered their children. Muhammad's harem was the worst-kept secret inside the nation. Over the past year, the FBI had collected sensitive information about his affairs. Agents noted that Muhammad had strict rules about adultery, forbidding married men from taking up time with other sisters. A Muslim man accused of fornicating outside his marriage risked facing not only a trial before the fruit, but also complete banishment from the nation. Brothers were supposed to respect Muslim women, glorify them, and guard their purity with their lives. Although Muhammad claimed that Muslim women should be elevated on pedestals, they were also instructed to show absolute obedience to their husbands. Women were segregated from men during rallies and taught domestic skills in comprehensive courses where they learned about cooking, sewing, and raising children. They were prohibited from wearing cosmetics, short skirts, or pants. Nor did women conduct religious services, organize meetings, or make decisions about the family. If a woman questioned her male partner in any way, she could receive a hard slap across the face. In some cases, Muhammad made his lovers endure farcical trials, charging them with immorality for bearing children out of wedlock and violating the nation's moral code. In other instances, he lavished his mistresses with gifts using money donated from the nation's followers. He promised some of his young paramours that they would raise a family together. But most often those promises went unfulfilled, and bitter women threatened to expose his lies. Some even showed up at his Chicago doorstep, ringing the bell, and leaving their babies on the stoop. The FBI realized that if Muhammad's followers learned about his affairs, the hypocrisy could lead to the downfall of the nation. The Bureau's agents recommended using carefully selected informants who would plant the seeds of dissension through anonymous letters and/or telephone calls. Specifically, they suggested mailing letters to his wife, Clara, even though she already knew all about his trysts. So did Malcolm X. Since 1955, he had heard whispers about Muhammad's infidelities. Initially, he discounted them as unsubstantiated gossip, denying any possibility that the messenger of Allah, his personal savior, could ever betray him and his followers. But the rumors persisted. He heard them everywhere he went, from New York to Chicago. By 1962, increasing numbers of Muslims began abandoning the nation, forcing him to finally admit what he had suspected for years. In his solitude, Malcolm's mind drifted to the image of Muhammad groping young women. Some nights he couldn't sleep. Other nights he woke up damp with perspiration, panicked that the world would soon know Muhammad's secret. Scandalous headlines jumped at him in his dreams. At some point, he feared, an investigative journalist would stick a microphone in his face and ask him, "Is it true, Mr. Malcolm X, this report we hear that..." How would he answer the question? How could he come to terms with the idea that the man he had built up as a moral paragon was actually a fraud? "I believed he was divine, divinely taught and divinely guided," Malcolm later admitted. "And it was only when Elijah Muhammad, something in his personal life, he found himself confronted with a moral question which he could not face up to as a man. And his failure to face up to that as a man made me begin to doubt him, not only as someone divine, divinely guided, but it made me doubt him as a man. And in the face of that, I began to analyze everything else he taught." Malcolm was not the only one concerned about the nation's future. Inside the Chicago headquarters, Muhammad's closest aides worried that his bronchial asthma and other ailments portended a leadership change. With Muhammad spending most of the year in Phoenix and his son Wallace serving prison time for draft evasion, Raymond Sharif, John Ali, and Muhammad's sons Herbert, Akbar, and Elijah Jr. expanded their influence over the sect. The junta enjoyed their growing power and the benefits that came with it. They lived an extravagant lifestyle, while Muhammad's mostly poor followers struggled to survive and pay a weekly duty of $3.30. In some mosques, the fruit demanded even higher tithes. Destitute blacks were urged to buy multiple copies of Muhammad Speaks, frequent the nation's businesses, and drop donations into collection plates during mass meetings. FBI informants noted that Muhammad's followers were continually harassed by NOI officials for greater and greater contributions. Muhammad instructed his closest advisors to purchase expensive cars and homes for him, to provide him with bodyguards and servants, and to give him other manifestations of affluence. He even referred to the nation's relief funds as "my checking account." In some ways, Elijah stoked his advisors' fears that Malcolm might reduce their influence in the nation. In February 1962, at the annual Savior's Day rally in Chicago, he openly referred to Malcolm as his heir apparent and chief aide. He also gave Malcolm the authority to resolve conflicts between members of different mosques. When Muhammad ordained him supreme authority by proxy, he gave Malcolm power that no other minister enjoyed, provoking deeper jealousies among his rivals. Malcolm's enemies charged him with avarice, a baseless accusation. Although he had access to the nation's treasury, he and Betty, his wife of 4 years, lived on a strict budget, owning virtually nothing, not even the house they lived in. When he traveled, rather than pay for a taxi ride to and from the airport, he asked fellow Muslims to give him a ride. He avoided expensive restaurants, collected receipts for every expense, and kept meticulous records of his purchases. Whenever he received money for campus lectures, he made sure that the checks were always written out to the NOI and not himself. In his ascetic lifestyle, Malcolm completely rejected his old life as Detroit Red. Although his austerity made him a more appealing political figure to the black masses, his adversaries resented his puritanical beliefs. With the nation's businesses thriving, Muhammad's cabinet feared that if he died and Malcolm replaced him, then Malcolm might terminate the spoils system. Benjamin 2X recalled, "There was a lot of money floating around, and a lot of people were spending money in areas where it shouldn't have been spent, and Malcolm spoke out against it. And they knew that if Mr. Muhammad had passed on, they would not have their positions anymore, because they were the first people that Malcolm would have gotten rid of." Malcolm had no aspirations of becoming the Supreme Minister. Uninterested in managing the national affairs of the Muslims or arbitrating disputes between Muhammad's children, he was far more concerned with the direction of the struggle for black freedom. The more he talked about confronting the white man, the more agitated his rivals in Chicago became. But after the Stokes murder, Malcolm no longer cared. He was on a mission, and now he would have to enlist foot soldiers of his own. If Muhammad wished that Malcolm would avoid further controversy, his hopes were soon dashed. At a rally in Harlem on Saturday, May 26th, he disobeyed Elijah Muhammad's order to stand down and suggested that Harlem's civil rights leaders coordinate a coalition against police brutality. On June 6th, at a press conference, pressure intensified when Los Angeles Mayor Sam Yorty played a police informant's recording of Malcolm speaking at a Muslim gathering. Referring to a plane crash in Paris that killed white passengers traveling from Atlanta, he declared, "I would like to announce a very beautiful thing that has happened. As you know, we have been praying to Allah. We have been praying that he would in some way let us know that he has the power to execute justice upon the heads of those who are responsible for the lynching of Ronald Stokes on April 27th. And I got a wire from God today," he said, over a chorus of laughter. "Wait, all right. Well, somebody came and told me that he answered our prayers over in France. He dropped an airplane out of the sky with over 120 white people on it." Since the Stokes case, he said, many blacks had asked him what the Muslims were going to do. "We call on our God," he answered. "He gets rid of 120 of them in one whop, and we hope that every day another plane falls out of the sky," he said, as the crowd roared with applause. Malcolm's comments shocked Americans, crystallizing his image as a demagogue who preached hatred. Immediately, civil rights leaders condemned him. In Atlanta, Martin Luther King canceled sit-ins against segregated restaurants and lunch counters out of respect for the city's mourners. "That's my hometown," he said. "I knew many of the people who were killed. Many of them believed in progress." When he was asked about Malcolm's comments, he answered, "If the Muslim leader said that, I would certainly disagree with him. Black supremacy is as dangerous as white supremacy." Facing a firestorm of criticism, Malcolm traveled to Detroit, where Elijah Muhammad was scheduled to deliver a major address at Olympia Stadium on June 10th. The Old Red Barn, as it was known in Motown, was a three-story Romanesque arena with arched windows built of steel, brown terracotta, and red brick. By noon, busloads of blacks had congregated outside the stadium on the corner of Grand River Avenue and McGraw Street. Uniformed police officers directed the traffic, while several thousand people braved the wind and rain. Shortly before 2 o'clock, when the rally was scheduled to begin, Cassius, Rudy, and Sam headed over to the stadium. In the crowded lobby, hundreds of earnest security guards patted down everyone who entered the building. Even Detroit's police commissioner submitted to a body search. After the Clay brothers passed inspection, the FOI Corps, communicating by walkie-talkie, ushered them into a long line of men who were escorted to their seats on the right side of the floor. Cassius had never seen such a spectacle of dignified-looking black people. All the men wearing dark suits, and all the women, seated on the left, dressed in immaculate white gowns and shawls. Reporters and cameramen covering the event sat in the very front rows, near the curious blacks who were not members of the nation. Cassius stretched his neck as he watched an honor guard escort Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm, and other officials onto the speaker's platform. Standing amid the awestruck silence, he felt the crowd's reverence for the messenger. After exchanging the traditional greetings, As-salamu alaykum and wa alaykum salam, Malcolm delivered his opening remarks and defended the nation's doctrine. "We are not a sect or a cult, nor are we a hate group," he asserted. "We are a group of people who have accepted the Islamic faith and believe that Allah is the supreme being." When Malcolm finished, Muhammad, the featured speaker, rose from his large chair like a royal descending from his throne and walked over to the lectern. Cassius listened attentively as the slight man with a receding hairline forcefully asserted that the so-called Negro had been enslaved for more than 400 years, echoing what Clay had heard at the Miami mosque. "That is a long time for a master to mistreat you," he said. For 2 hours, Muhammad zealously preached, while Cassius and Rudy sat well back in the crowded arena, practically leading the applause. Flanked by 20 to 30 members of the fruit, Muhammad declared, "The time to rise is now." It was time for black men to renounce the games of white men, he urged. Time to abandon the struggle for integration and turn inward, looking to Allah's messenger for salvation. Muhammad condemned the Los Angeles police for murdering Ronald Stokes and reminded his parents, the honored guests, that their son did not die in vain. The white man's day of judgment, he promised, would come before long. Muhammad demanded a separate state where blacks could live independently from whites. Malcolm sat just a few feet away from him, nodding with approval as he listened. "We must remember that we are two different people, and we must be separate. That is the only way out." The message Clay heard that day jived with what he had learned from his father. "Keep your distance from white men. They will never treat a black man fairly." It reinforced what he had read in newspapers and magazines and seen on television. Images of the mutilated body of Emmett Till, the bombing of Martin Luther King's Montgomery home, and a white mob assaulting black teenagers outside a Little Rock high school. That day in Detroit changed Clay's life. There was something about Malcolm, his swagger, the dazzle in his smile, the way that everyone in the diner watched him, that alerted Cassius that the brother minister, who, in the words of activist Dick Gregory, spoke like a poor man and walked like a king, possessed an unbridled confidence and an audacity to speak his mind in a way that no one else did. "My first impression of Malcolm X was, how could a black man talk about the government and white people and act so bold and not be shot at? How could he say these things? Only God must be protecting him," Clay said later. Malcolm was unlike anyone he had ever met. "He was fearless. That really attracted me." Malcolm had magnetized Clay, drawing him toward the inner circle of the nation. He had no idea the effect he had on the young boxer that day in Detroit, but he would soon see him again. At the end of the rally, after Clay departed Olympia Stadium, all members of the NOI were required to remain seated. Malcolm read a letter from Supreme Captain Raymond Sharif requiring every Muslim to obtain no less than 2 subscriptions of Muhammad Speaks per day for 3 months. Those who failed to meet the sales quota would be eliminated from the mosque. Since Stokes's death, the captains of every mosque had pressed their members to sell more copies of the newspaper. Muhammad Speaks not only offered the nation an independent platform, but also, more importantly, generated significant revenue for the organization. After the Stokes murder, instead of printing the newspaper on a monthly basis, Chicago officials began publishing the periodical biweekly. Supposedly, the issue that covered his funeral sold more than 400,000 copies, a misleading figure since an unknown number of copies belonged to members who were forced to purchase stacks of the newspaper in cash but never actually sold them to others. On Sunday, July 29th, at 2 p.m., Malcolm attended a fundraising benefit for Stokes's family at the Boston Arena. In the hours before the rally, Muslims stood on the corners of St. Botolph Street and Massachusetts Avenue, selling a special reprint edition of Muhammad Speaks, featuring gruesome pictures of Stokes, that resembled the images of Emmett Till's disfigured face in Jet magazine. An autopsy photo displayed Stokes lying on his back, his bare chest exposed with deep stitches, and his skull lacerated and bruised from policemen's nightsticks. Inside the tabloid were pictures of black men tethered to trees and hanging from nooses. In an open letter to five black congressmen, Malcolm argued that Stokes was as innocent as Mack Parker, Emmett Till, or Isaac Woodard, all victims of Southern lynchings. Despite the propaganda value of the Stokes murder, Muslim men in Boston resented the sales quotas, which were imposed under the guise of raising money for Stokes's family. His cousin, Aubrey Barnett, would later claim that Ronald's wife and baby never received a dime from the Muslims' national or local treasuries. The Nation, he charged, was nothing more than a money-grabbing scheme feeding on the frustrations and the ignorance of Negroes. When Muhammad's followers failed to bring in money, his lieutenants resorted to terror, violence, and extortion. As a secretary of the mosque, Barnett witnessed how Captain Clarence X and his terror squad intimidated Boston Muslims into buying more copies of Muhammad Speaks than they could sell. If Captain Clarence and his lieutenants could not collect money from the men, they took them for a ride to Franklin Park and taught them a painful lesson about financial obligations. When more than 40 men quit the mosque, Elijah Muhammad Jr., Assistant Supreme Commander of the Fruit, visited Boston, reminding the faithful that, in the old days, recalcitrant brothers were killed. And, he warned, the messenger fulfills all. Disillusioned with the Nation, Barnett left the mosque nearly 2 years later. But no Muslim ever really left the Nation. Captain Clarence made sure of that. One afternoon, when Barnett and another former Muslim drove past the mosque in Roxbury, a pink Cadillac cut them off. In broad daylight, Clarence and his squad dragged Barnett from the car, punching and stomping on him, fracturing his ankle, ribs, and vertebrae. "I believe," he said later, "we were beaten as punishment for quitting, and also as a warning to us to keep our mouths shut." The fratricidal violence within the Nation usually occurred out of sight, far removed from anything Cassius Clay ever saw in the mosques that he visited. But tales of attacks against obstinate blacks terrified Muhammad's followers. Although he refused to let the Fruit retaliate against whites, Muhammad approved corporal punishment against his own people. Such abuse alienated many members. In Harlem, a street corner speaker complained to Louis Lomax, "Those damn Muslims are too scared to do anything to the white man. All they do is talk and beat up on other niggers." In mid-August, after Elijah Muhammad delivered a sermon to a disappointingly small crowd in St. Louis, he attempted to tighten his hold on Malcolm. In a private meeting, Elijah told the increasingly disobedient minister that he disapproved of the way that he deviated from his message, talking publicly about politics and civil rights. In the following months, Muhammad reminded him not to make any more appearances on college campuses without receiving his permission. Before agreeing to let Malcolm speak anywhere, Muhammad wanted to know exactly how he would carry out such a program in advance. For a time, Malcolm decided that he should avoid the spotlight. He declined cover story requests from Life and Newsweek and turned down a television interview on Meet the Press. He also noticed that his name and picture disappeared from the pages of Muhammad Speaks after Herbert Muhammad replaced him as editor. Elijah resented all the attention focused on Malcolm, even though he had made him the Nation's spokesman. He especially disliked the way that people lionized Malcolm for his intellectual superiority and rhetorical eloquence. Muhammad's insecurities festered, fueling his paranoia over comparisons to the younger man, who claimed that he had learned everything from Elijah. But unlike Malcolm, Muhammad made grammatical errors in his speeches and stumbled over words he did not recognize. Lacking any formal education beyond the fourth grade, he struggled while reading aloud. His sermons rarely impressed or excited audiences the way that Malcolm's did. "To be able to listen to Muhammad for any length of time," one observer commented, You had to be a believer, convinced in advance. Muhammad worried that the controversy surrounding Malcolm's public appearances would invite closer scrutiny from the government. On August 15th, 3 days after the St. Louis rally, Congressman Francis E. Walter, chairman of the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, condemned the black Muslims as a subversive group influenced by communists and announced that an investigation would begin soon. When he heard about the HUAC probe, Muhammad became agitated. Although the Muslims were ardent anti-communists, the government suspected that a tinge of red ran through their teachings. It did not help that 2 years earlier, in Harlem, Malcolm had met with Cuban revolutionary Fidel Castro without Elijah's approval. Castro had been in New York to condemn the United States before the United Nations. At the time, Muhammad had suspected that the meeting would come back to haunt him. But Malcolm maintained, "We will welcome any investigation. We have nothing to hide." Malcolm may have believed that he had nothing to hide, but Cassius Clay did. A month after HUAC announced that it would investigate the nation, the heavyweight contender appeared in a photograph at the bottom of a page in the September 15th issue of Muhammad Speaks. Dressed in a dark suit, white shirt, and bow tie, Clay seemed completely comfortable smiling for the camera, as if someone were snapping a picture of him and his brother at a family reunion rather than at a Muslim rally in St. Louis. No one interviewed him for Muhammad Speaks, as athletes received little coverage in the paper. He was not yet considered an important figure in the Muslims' national agenda, but for the second time in 2 months, he traveled a great distance to hear Elijah Muhammad and to spend more time with Malcolm. Clay's fascination with the nation evolved alongside his growing notoriety as a boxer. At a time when the government planned an extensive, if unwarranted, investigation into the organization, Clay risked his boxing career by associating with the nation. Remarkably, the blacks who saw him in Detroit and St. Louis never shared that information with reporters. If a black rider recognized him at one of the rallies or noticed his picture in Muhammad Speaks, or a white rider caught wind of him shaking hands with Malcolm X, it could have ended his career. Chapter 5. The Winter of Boxing. The boxing game was slowly dying, and fight promoters were bitterly crying for someone somewhere to come along for a better and different song. Patterson was dull, quiet, and sad, and Sonny Liston was just as bad. Along came a kid named Cassius Clay, who said, "I'll take Liston's title away." Cassius Clay, Ebony, March 1963. Cassius Clay's involvement with the nation was not the only threat to his career. Prize fighting was in a sorry state and was dying in New York. By 1962, everything wrong with the sport, from its endemic mismatches and ring fatalities to its shady characters and fixed fights, was magnified in Gotham. There had been a time when millions of Americans followed the big New York fights of Joe Louis and Rocky Marciano, and reporters trumpeted the results on front-page headlines. Now, the coverage of boxing had spilled over into the crime pages. The New York Times, as well as such national publications as Sports Illustrated and Time, featured the illegal antics of promoters, managers, and fighters. To make matters worse, Sonny Liston, the most dynamic heavyweight of the early 1960s, had a past so nefarious that he was barred from fighting in the Empire State. Always the bellwether for the sport, the New York fight game pealed as mournfully as a death knell. Boxing needed a heavyweight savior, and no contender was rising more quickly or loudly than the undefeated Louisville Lip. The question was whether he could ascend fast enough to reverse the rapid descent of the sport. Less than a month after disposing of George Logan in Los Angeles in April 1962, Clay was back in New York for another test. Matched against Billy Daniels, a former Air Force boxer who was 10-0 as a professional, the publicist promoted the contest as a fight between the two finest young heavyweights in America. But Cassius promised to finish him in the fifth round, telling reporters, "I would be embarrassed if he lasted any more." The match was a disappointment. Only 1,642 spectators attended the bout at New York's historic St. Nicholas Arena, and neither boxer lived up to their hype. Daniels came out in the first and hit Clay with a powerful left-right combination. As the customers cheered lustily, Cassius tottered and blinked his eyes, then went on his bicycle in an effort to avoid further damage. In the second and third rounds, Clay came back. He bloodied Daniels's nose in the second and cut his right eyebrow in the third. It was a deep, ugly gash, and Daniels's cut man could not effectively stop the bleeding. In the fourth, Clay went to work on the eye, and by the seventh, the blood was hampering Daniels's vision. At that point, the referee stopped the fight. The Daniels contest may have been a slip for Clay, but it was no knockdown. He had won, and his undefeated record stood fast. All he needed to continue his ascent was a convincing victory over a contender. With his keen sense for fighters just beginning their decline, Angelo Dundee accepted an offer against Alejandro Lavarante in Los Angeles. In November 1961, Lavarante, bare-chested, his fists up in a fighter's pose, appeared on the cover of The Ring. In the accompanying feature story, Nat Fleischer made him seem like the future of the division. Pinky George, his American manager, asserted that the 25-year-old was ready to fight anyone. "This is the year of the astronaut," he told the magazine's editor. "Everyone is shooting for the moon. We're doing the same." It wasn't all hyperbole. Lavarante knocked out highly rated Zora Folly and became a ranked contender. But he fought too often and was brought along too fast. On March 30, 1962, former light heavyweight champion Archie Moore gave Lavarante a cruel boxing lesson. Struggling to compete, swallowing too much of his own blood, the Argentine boxer absorbed a frightful beating. After the referee stopped the bout in the 10th round, Lavarante slumped to the ropes and had to be taken to his dressing room on a stretcher. Less than 4 months after the defeat, Lavarante was back in the ring against a younger, stronger, better-conditioned boxer than ancient Archie Moore. He was at a crossroads. A loss to Clay would be more significant, indicating that his career was sinking, and boxing insiders recognized it. When two fighters are on the way up, they avoid each other as scrupulously as two women wearing the same dress at a party, wrote Jim Murray. Before the Moore fight, Angelo Dundee would have never matched Cassius against Lavarante. But Archie had exposed him, and it was clear to Dundee that the tango was over for the Argentine. Clay dominated the bout from the opening bell. He staggered Lavarante in the second, opened a cut over his left eye in the fourth, and knocked him down twice in the fifth. Sprawled wide-legged on the canvas after the second knockdown, the Argentine took a full 10 count. Lavarante rose slowly but recovered before heading back to the dressing room. His manager was grim. A few days before the contest, Pinky George had commented that the fight was critical to his boxer's future. "It's back to the minors if we lose," he predicted. 2 months after losing to Clay, he fought Johnny Riggins, a preliminary boxer who had lost 7 of his previous 9 matches. In the 6th round, Riggins landed a series of punches, the final one a vicious uppercut that twisted Lavarante's brainstem, causing thread-like veins to hemorrhage. His head swiveled violently, and his eyes rolled to the tops of the sockets. He did not so much fall as crumble, finally coming to rest in an awkward sitting position against the lower rope, his head dropping in a sleeping position toward his chest, and his arms falling lifeless into his lap. An ambulance rushed Lavarante to California Lutheran Hospital, and a surgeon operated immediately to remove blood clots and relieve pressure on his brain. But the fighter never recovered. He sank into a coma, and on April Fool's Day, 1964, 19 months after his last boxing match, he died. He had arrived in America just over 4 years before. An overly ambitious manager had filled his head with dreams of shooting for the moon. But in the ring, Alejandro Lavarante was like a child playing in traffic, a blind man heading for a cliff. And rather than intervening, people paid to see it. The fate of Alejandro Lavarante epitomized the state of boxing in the late 1950s and early 1960s. In the years between the emergence of Joe Louis in 1935 and the retirement of Rocky Marciano in 1956, the sport luxuriated in a golden age of great fighters and matches, enormous attention and popularity, and million-dollar gates. When World War II ended, television, just in its infancy, fell in love with pugilism, and by the mid-1950s, a fight was being broadcast virtually every night of the week. As comedian Red Skelton quipped, "The Monday fight, scheduled for Tuesday this Wednesday, has been postponed till Thursday and rescheduled for Friday this Saturday because Sunday's a holiday." Then, with unimaginable speed, it ended. The great fighters retired, or worse, kept fighting after their skills had eroded. Television's romance with the sport resulted in a series of financially rocky divorces. Louis and Marciano were replaced by lesser men who were only willing to risk their titles against still lesser boxers. Even worse, a series of exposés and criminal investigations revealed boxing's hideous underbelly of violent mobsters, fixed fights, heartless exploitation, and battered fighters. The problems of the sport were years in the making, but they crystallized before a national television audience in Madison Square Garden on the night of Saturday, March 24, 1962. That evening, ABC's The Fight of the Week pitted Cuban Benny the Kid Perret against Virgin Islander Emile Griffith for the welterweight championship. The two had battled for the title twice before, Griffith winning the first in a knockout and Perret taking the second in a close decision. There was also bad blood between them. At the morning weigh-in, when Griffith stripped to his underwear and stepped on the scale, the Spanish-speaking Perret moved in close and grabbed Griffith's ass, whispering, "Hey, maricón, faggot, I'm going to get you and your husband." That word, maricón, which Gilbert Rogan of Sports Illustrated called the most vulgar epithet in that violent idiom, and the touch, enraged Griffith. His high-pitched voice, tight clothes, and former career as a hat designer had started rumors that he was gay. He jerked away from Perret's touch, telling him to shut up and to keep his hands off him, or he would fight him then and there. In the early rounds, the fight was close, but by the 12th, Griffith staggered Perret with several devastating blows. The next seconds were unquestionably the most violent in recorded boxing history. Punching faster than most observers could count, as Robert L. Teague of the New York Times wrote, Griffith wailed on Perret, landing punch after punch with deadly force. He connected six or seven times with right uppercuts to the point of the chin, and then landed more lefts and rights to Perret's face and temples. In just a matter of seconds, Teague thought that Griffith landed 25 unanswered punches. It might have been more, but the exact number hardly mattered. Perret was unconscious, entangled in the corner ropes, well before referee Ruby Goldstein stepped between the two boxers. As Goldstein pulled Griffith away from Perret, the Cuban slowly slid from the corner ropes to the canvas. Ringside observer Norman Mailer later wrote that he sensed death in the air, as Perret gave an unconscious half-smile and then fell more slowly than any fighter had ever gone down. He went down like a large ship, which turns on its end and slides second by second into its grave. The bout ended, and the ring swarmed with activity. The senior ringside physician called for a stretcher, while TV announcer Don Dunphy scrambled into the ring to get a statement from Emile. After saying how happy he was to regain the title, Griffith added, "I hope Perret is feeling very good." Ignoring the chaos in the ring, Dunphy decided that the time was right to unveil ABC's newly developed slow-motion replay system. In nightmarish slow motion, with Emile narrating his brutal beating of Benny, the last conscious seconds of Perret's life were replayed, the man who beat him to death providing the color. All Griffith could do was describe inarticulately how he had killed his opponent. On April 3rd, 10 days after the fight, Perrette died without ever regaining consciousness. His death introduced a new vocabulary into the sport. Phrases like traumatic brain injury and subdural hemorrhage and edema sounded like a foreign language to boxing fans, but reflected the sweet science's new reality. The horrible end of the Griffith-Perrette fight had both immediate and longer-range consequences. While Perrette was still in a coma, journalists and politicians began debating the future of a sport where the object is to knock an opponent loose from his senses. In the days after the match, politicians demanded that New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller do something, form a commission, ban the sport, or at least speak out against it. Ultimately, the state legislature formed a committee to investigate whether prize fighting should be abolished altogether. Perrette died 2 years before the Fight of the Week did, but only because of existing contracts between the network and the sponsors. His death prompted industry executives to re-examine its relationship with the sport. In fact, boxing's television ratings had been declining for years, down from about a third of the available audience to a tenth. One by one, the national weekly shows that had appeared in the 1940s and 1950s went off the air by 1962. All that remained was the Fight of the Week, which ABC aired from 1960 to 1964. The combination of ring deaths, criminal influence, public opposition, and declining ratings made ABC reconsider the renewal of their contract with the Gillette Safety Razor Company, which began sponsoring the show after NBC canceled the Gillette Cavalcade of Sports in 1960. The fact that the demographics of boxing were all wrong, that is, its audience was not only dwindling but also generally poorer and older, was as devastating as Griffith's punches. Increasingly, TV executives demanded shows that appealed to the youth market, ranging from The Addams Family and Bewitched to Shindig and Hullabaloo to the many loves of Dobie Gillis and Peyton Place, not programs where men were battered bloody and killed. Boxing's core audience of World War II and Korean War veterans from ethnic, working-class backgrounds with limited education and disposable incomes were proving a poor fit for the age of John Kennedy, John Glenn, and the Beach Boys. 2 days before Christmas in 1963, ABC announced that it planned to cancel the Fight of the Week when its new season began. The program, which had begun less than 4 months after the D-Day invasion, ended on September 11, 1964. Harry Markson, director of boxing for Madison Square Garden, predicted that the end of the long-running show would not be fatal to boxing. In fact, he foresaw the very opposite. But his tone sounded off-key. Most critics thought that the cancellation of the Fight of the Week was another portent of the slow death of the sport. With boxing on its deathbed, Cassius Clay sensed an opportunity. He understood that there was truth in the old axiom, "The health of boxing follows the popularity of the heavyweight champion." What the sport needed, he calculated, was a dynamic, entertaining title holder. In his view, Floyd Patterson and Sonny Liston, the top two heavyweights, were incapable of saving the sport. Only he could remedy boxing's ills. At the beginning of 1962, Patterson held the title, which he had won in 1956 after Marciano retired, lost in 1959 when he was knocked out by Swedish Ingemar Johansson, and regained in 1960 when he in turn knocked out Johansson. Floyd was a good, compassionate, complex man, in a profession normally dominated by men with other attributes, and the crown of Dempsey, Lewis, and Marciano was an uncomfortable fit for him, a fact not lost on Clay. Cassius thought that boxing needed a champion who was great, not one who ran from challengers and lost to Scandinavians. Patterson grew up in poverty in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. As an adult, he was so timid, shy, and withdrawn that even when he became a successful professional prize fighter, he could not look his opponents in the eyes before a fight. After one match, he gently kissed the man he had just knocked out. Sports writers accused him of gross, pugilistic malfeasance, that is, As a champion, he had not defended his title against the best contenders. Most of his defenses were against mid-ranked, smaller heavyweights with overblown records, who, perhaps not coincidentally, were white. He consistently avoided top-rated heavyweights, and he steered widely clear of Sonny Liston, generally regarded between 1960 and 1962 as the top contender in the division. Unlike Patterson, Liston had fought and defeated virtually every other major contender. Sonny, whose nickname seemed singularly inappropriate, had a past, and much of it was bad. The first murky fact about his life was his exact age. When he needed a date of birth on an application to fight in the 1953 Golden Gloves tournament, he gave May 8, 1932. His mother told one reporter that she thought it was January 8, 1932, and another January 18, 1932. But those dates only set the upper range for the speculations that included 1931, 1930, and back into the 1920s. Over time, Sonny developed an effective tactic for shutting down questions about his birth date. When a scribe probed the subject, Liston would throw him a glance as cold as a gravestone at midnight and say, "Anyone who says I wasn't born in 1932 is calling my mama a liar." By his own reckoning, he was one of 25 children sired by Toby Liston, a brutal, abusive father who sharecropped a small patch of ground near Forest City, Arkansas. He beat his son so often that if a day passed without a hard whooping, Sonny would wake his dad at night and ask, "How come you didn't whoop me today?" Lines of bird-track scars down his back testified to the frequency and severity of the beatings. And by the time he was 12, Sonny had endured enough. As he told sports columnist Jerry Eisenberg, one day the family's mule died, prompting Toby to say to Sonny, "Boy, you're the mule now." Not relishing the promotion, he ran away from home early the next morning. He caught a train to St. Louis, where his mother lived with several of his brothers and sisters. But the reunion did not solve his problems. Instead of attending school, he remained functionally illiterate all his life. He took to the streets and alleys of St. Louis, running with the wrong sorts of people and embracing a life of crime like it was his calling. As he once said, "I had a tendency to find things before they got lost." "He's a bad man," commented Detective Sergeant James Reddick. He was a bad man, who brutally mugged innocent people, held up small businesses at gunpoint, and did not get away with it. In 1950, he was arrested, tried, convicted, and sentenced to 5 years in the Missouri State Penitentiary in Jefferson City.
And that will do it for our first audio segment, Context of White Supremacy, Blood Brothers, the Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. If folks have comments they would like to share, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6. If you would like to participate, that number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone to dial into the program, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinyty.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Address again, tinyty.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. When you put in that address, click the link on the left of the page. It says free VOPE line. When you click that, it will open a window, small window on your screen. The top line It is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. The final line, it will ask for a name. You can use a nickname, real name. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the program. You should be able to hear us live. It is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. Once you do that, you'll hear an audio prompt to press the number 1. Do so. I will see your hand on the screen, and we will add you to the line. Right on. With that, we will get to folks who dialed in who have a hand up. If you all have comments you would like to share on the first portion of the audiobook, you should be with us. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus.
Greetings. Go ahead, sir. Go ahead.
You sure?
Go ahead.
No problem. Thank you so much. Gus, this book is awesome. I found something, weirdly enough, on page 57 that I believe was an act of racism by the authors. They wrote here, without authorization to retaliate, Malcolm instead escalated his rhetoric. On May 4th, a week after the shooting, Malcolm held a press conference in Los Angeles at the Statler Hilton Hotel and accused the police of murdering Stokes. 7 innocent unarmed black men were shot down in cold blood by Police Chief William Parker's Los Angeles City Police, he charged. He thought that Parker, who sometimes pronounced Negroes as niggers, was guilty of filling his own men with hatred of the black community and spreading lies about the Muslims. In Los Angeles, Malcolm argued blacks lived under a police state just like the Jews in Nazi Germany. And where I feel he practiced racism was in his use of the term rhetoric. When I looked up the meaning of the term, and he used it a couple of times in this reading, rhetoric, one of the meanings of rhetoric says language designed to have a persuasive or impressive effect on its audience, but often regarded as lacking in sincerity or meaningful content. And first, for him to use the term speaks to the fact that he realized, or he understood, the authors understood, that black people had no power to effectively change our situation. And it was disrespectful to me to what Malcolm was saying by implying to me that it lacked sincerity or meaningful content. And that's where I feel like they were practicing racism. Like I said, there's other paragraphs where they use that word rhetoric specifically in a very similar way, and I just found that to be just very telling as far as the use of language. On page 60, there is a paragraph that says, although Muhammad claimed that Muslim women should be elevated on pedestals, they were also instructed to show absolute obedience to their husbands. Women were segregated from men during rallies and taught domestic skills and comprehensive courses where they learned about cooking, sewing, and raising children. They were prohibited from wearing cosmetics, short skirts or pants, nor did women conduct religious services, organize meetings, or make decisions about the family. If a woman questioned her male partner in any way, she could receive a hard slap across the face. And this just made me think of as much positive work as the Nation of Islam did do. Sadly, patriarchy, which is another aspect of white supremacy and this oppression of women and abuse of women, is not historically a traditional African trait. And I just found it just telling that sort of potentially violent patriarchy, you know, was going on within the Nation of Islam. And that's just something that felt kind of stood out to me. There was on page 62, actually two brief paragraphs that I found were very telling. It says, Malcolm's enemies charged him with avarice, a baseless accusation. Although he had access to the nation's treasury, he and Betty, his wife of 4 years, lived on a strict budget, owning virtually nothing. not even the house they lived in. When he traveled, rather than paying for a taxi ride to and from the airport, he asked fellow Muslims to give him a ride. He avoided expensive restaurants, collected receipts for every expense, and kept meticulous records of his purchases. Whenever he received money for campus lectures, he made sure that the checks were always written out to the NOI and not to himself. In his ascetic lifestyle, Malcolm completely rejected his old life as Detroit Red. I found that first paragraph to be very telling as far as Malcolm's codification, the fact that he did not use white people's taxis, but actually look to fellow Muslims to give him a ride. That kind of reminded me of Dr. Cambon when he said that his consciousness had shifted in a way in which he did as much as he could to no longer participate in the system. And I just found that to be a great form of codification. Also, I just found that paragraph also gives very deep insight into the dedication that Malcolm had and the fact that when he did transform his life, it was a holistic transformation. And I believe just based on the fact that all of that information, that negative information about Elijah Muhammad having these mistresses, I think might have also facilitated him being even more staunch about being having a life that could be beyond reproach as far as when people scrutinized him. It's funny because I always used him as an example when my son was coming up about what an upstanding black male would be beyond giving him those traditional African values of understanding the power of living as righteous a life as possible. And I just found that to be very telling. The next paragraph, it says, although his austerity made him a more appealing political figure to the black masses, his adversaries resented his puritanical beliefs. With the nation's businesses thriving, Muhammad's cabinet feared that if he died and Malcolm replaced him, then Malcolm might terminate the spoiled system. Benjamin 2X recalled. There was a lot of money floating around, and a lot of people were spending money in areas where it shouldn't have been spent. And Malcolm spoke out against it, and they knew that if Muhammad had passed on, they would not have their positions anymore because they were the first people that Malcolm would have gotten rid of. And again, this goes to show that even within the nation, they understood that he was really a deeply, deeply dedicated man who really, really transformed his life. And obviously, they had quite a few unscrupulous figures in high positions within the nation that understood that Malcolm actually did, you know, tried to live such a righteous life, to the point that they knew that their days of having fun at the expense of the Nation of Islam would be over. And of course, I think that helped to facilitate them really, really putting that rift between Elijah Muhammad and Minister Malcolm X. Lastly, I would just want to touch on the last thing on page 67, where it says, the fratricidal violence within the nation usually occurred out of sight, far removed from anything Cassius Clay ever saw in the mosque that he visited. But tales of attacks against obstinate blacks terrified Muhammad's followers. Although he refused to let the fruit retaliate against whites, Muhammad approved corporal punishment against his own people. Such abuse alienated many members. In Harlem, a street corner speaker complained to Louis Lomax, those damn Muslims are too scared to do anything to the white man. All they do is talk and beat up on other niggas. And I just found that very interesting as well, that Elijah Muhammad did allow and encourage anti-blackness in the form of black-on-black violence. I thought that was just not a positive thing whatsoever. Of course, he is a victim, but still, that was just something that I felt was just not positive whatsoever. And again, he was encouraging peace towards our eternal enemies, yet it's okay for us to fight amongst ourselves. So in a way, he kind of played the role of an overseer that had a group of black people that he could use to abuse other black people. So I just found that to be very telling as far as that organized form of anti-blackness. And eventually it seemed that the Nation of Islam started to function more like a gang than a spiritual/religious organization. And thank you for taking my call.
For sure. We got disconnected momentarily, but we should be back for the folks listening in online. Other folks who had comments that they wanted to share should be with us. If you have a hand up, your line should be open.
Yes, sir. And everybody, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I just start off by saying the life and times of Charles Sonny Liston is a project of study unto itself about anti-blackness and the whole structure of racism, white supremacy, and the suffering of non-white victims, non-white black victims in the southern part of the penitentiary that's called America. Number one, as Malcolm was getting interviewed, started getting interviewed by quote-unquote mainstream press, his comments became more threatening. You know, just by the mainstream press in itself, is going to be able to be heard or seen by more and more people. And it became threatening to the power of white supremacy, understanding that his language would be able to influence more than just Nation of Islam members. You know, certain people have that kind of talent to be able to articulate in a way that all aspects of a environment, no matter whether you got a lot of money, whether you got a degree or not, and you can that person can say something, and you would quickly, very quickly, have a better understanding of what's going on. That's one of the pluses. That's one of the pluses of Mr. Fuller's works. It does that also. His activities, meaning Malcolm X, his activities also frightened a lot of Nation of Islam members. Also, and I believe, in my personal opinion, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, because a lot of them just wanted to focus as a much more smaller, much more quieter situation, and I've heard one of the members state about Malcolm in a negative. They just wanted to focus on religion, quote unquote. In all actuality, that Los Angeles situation was one of the big signs of beginning of the animosity between Malcolm X, who was the national representative of the Nation of Islam, and the membership, and a lot of primarily the administration, which resided in Chicago. At this time, the FBI, because I'm gonna keep my focus on where the problem comes from, powerful white people. Some of them were in an organization called the FBI, used deception, and the technology of the day was telephones, telephone calls, letters, you know, written, you know, paper written stuff that would deceive Malcolm or certain members of the Nation of Islam, specifically the administration in the Chicago area. And eventually the ministry, for the most part, really started having a big problem with Malcolm X, which in result, it came to a point in time where he was being indicted for treason, basically. To whereas I can remember, and you can still see it in some of the archive, Muhammad speaks with his image with horns on his head, and it obviously had been chopped off and rolling down the street. These type of things were being put in in the newspaper to where most, if not all of the members had access to in one way or the other. I've mentioned prior too that the problem of the main, probably the main resource of selling the newspapers, a lot of members were really put in financial stress because they had to either sell the newspapers, or like my dad, he actually, the ones he couldn't sell, I remember they used to be all stacked up in the barbershop, in the basement of the barbershop. that he cut hair at, and because he couldn't sell, he couldn't sell them, but he was forced to buy them. You know, so that was had a lot of problems with that. A lot of male members who were primarily were the sellers of the newspapers. What else I have here? Yeah, almost everything that Malcolm X had as far as possessions actually belonged to the Nation of Islam. He had an old Oldsmobile. That was the car that he drove to the Audubon Ballroom, which in turn he actually didn't drive it all the way there. He drove it down the street and parked it. The house, the same one that was firebombed, as we all know, it went through court proceedings, and the court actually gave it in favor of the Nation of Islam, that house. What else I have out here? The whole thing about the Nation of Islam, it reminds me of what Mr. Fuller identifies as the failure of four-wallism. You know, how easily, within about 15 minutes after you form an organization under the global system of racism, white supremacy, they've already implanted the disease that's going to destroy it. Already. I got down here also, most boxers, white and non-white, were controlled by white suspected racists who were called gangsters. Cassius Clay was controlled by wealthy racist suspects who were business gangsters. He basically, the mainstream press would say that he escaped the gangsters, but I just look at it, it's all in the same, you know, just a different a door within the same building. These guys were like business gangsters in a sense. I heard the name Zora Foley. Zora Foley, black male, was actually the last opponent that Muhammad Ali had before he was stripped of his license, his ability to fight, to make a living. That was his last fight in 1967, and was a knockout of Mr. Foley. He didn't hurt him anything like that, but he was defeated by a knockout. I believe the Griffin Parrott fight was in Miami. I could be wrong, but I believe it was in Miami at the time. And if you ever saw you can see the film of it. If you ever saw it, you would see that boxing is not a sport. I put it this way, if it is a sport, I have to question on what is the meaning of a sport. Because it's almost like, I mean, it's no different than what I would imagine two people fighting each other in the street and one had the intent to beat another person to death. But that's actually what you would see. It's in black and white, but it's very clear if one would was curious enough to look at it. And that's all I have for right now. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Any of the other folks who dialed in with a hand up, do y'all have comments you want to get in as well? Your volume is over. It's a little hard to hear you, Thomas. Still not hearing you. I guess he'll dial back in. Other folks that we have not heard from, did you all want to comment while we wait to see if Thomas dials back in so we can hear him a little better?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to hosts, listeners, and the callers. Just a couple of observations. Start out, is the narrator a white person?
Yes.
And the author of the book, is the author a white person?
There are two authors, Randy Roberts, Johnny Smith, and they are both white.
Okay. I would start by saying that it seemed that the highlight between the disagreement and or rift between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, it seemed, how I want to say, it seemed a lot of emphasis was put on their disagreement and certain language that he used. The authors sounds very, how I want to say, racist, I guess that would be the best way to put it. really trying to make the Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X seem, I guess I would say, just not seen in the best light. I would say that the Elijah Muhammad, it sounded like the way it was written, it sounded almost more like a cult versus a religion. And coming up as I was born in 81, and coming up as a child, Muslims always got kind of like looked down upon. And as I'm listening to the text, it seems as though the rift between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, that's why it was highlighted to really kind of just focus on the negative versus the positive things that they was putting forth. And something that stood out to me, last caller was saying he was questioning if boxing was a sport, and the way that the author described I think it was a boxer that got his brain stem turned around from a punch. The question I wanted to ask about that, was that Muhammad Ali fighting this person that when his brain stem was turned?
No.
Or was that a different? That was okay. But yeah, it sounded very brutal. The guy, the fight where the guy died in the ring, you know, had me kind of questioning, like, you know, what's really going on. It kind of put me in the mind of the fighting scene in Django Unchained when they had two black guys kind of going at it or whatever. And thanks for taking the call. I'm Ian Milan.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. Thomas in New York is back with us now. We'll try it again and see if his line is a little clear. Thomas in New York, did you have a commentary you were going to share?
Yes, I'm here, Taylor.
That is better.
Yes, I definitely think boxing is a sport. You know, however, I don't think baseball and tennis are. But I think boxing is basketball, football. But either way, with the book is, you know, it sounds a lot like the Alex Haley book to me. It's like, I bet some of these paragraphs are probably
A little difficult to hear you, just not as clear.
Better?
Give us another
Hello?
Sentence. That's better.
Okay, it sounds a lot like the Alex Haley book to me. Like, I almost would think that some of these paragraphs is probably word for word. I think that I hate the... Man, I just hate to hear about the rift in the Nation of Islam, because I don't know if that's, you know, exactly what happened. I like to think that the members, you know, the other prominent members, you know, formed a, you know, the alliance together against, you know, Malcolm X, but maybe without the knowledge of Elijah Muhammad. But nonetheless, I hate that a white person is writing about that. Yeah, that just, like, you know, they could do whatever with that writing and you know, mix things around. Other than that, you know, it's almost like, and I do think that this could have been true. You know, I mean, you know, when you're talking about money, you know, people act, you know, a little different. And it's like Malcolm was one, the one cop that didn't that went into the drug house and didn't take the money, and now all the other cops is like, uh-oh, gotta watch him. You know, he's too straight and narrow. You know, he's uncorruptible. You know, he's the person that has to go. And I really think that's what happened. But thus far, sounds good. I mean, it's informative. I'll mute my line.
Hang on. For other folks that have commentary, they want to get in, get your hand up. Don't wait till the last minute. We get into the second audio segment as it gets closer to the bottom of the hour. Some of the quick things I wanted to get in. Boxing is pretty brutal, regardless, I guess, of where you come down or whether or not it's a sport or not. I do know Mr. Fuller has said pretty consistently that boxing should be done away with, like abolished. Like, that is absurd for someone to, for parents and a family to invest all that time and energy and trouble in raising a child and educating them and everything that goes into that, to then have them go in a ring and have someone, you know, dedicate months of training to saying, I'm going to beat this person until they quit or die or cannot walk anymore. I mean, that is absurd. Beastly. Like, it is terrible. And just the beating people to death, I mean, that still happens, where people just get savagely mauled and killed in the ring. I remember the trainers for Joe Frazier, when he fought Muhammad Ali for the third time, his corner stopped the fight at the end of the 14th round. Muhammad Ali passed out at that point, even though he did win. He was about done, too. But they asked Joe Frazier's trainers if they think they did the correct thing, because Muhammad Ali was about to quit and Joe Frazier could have won their third fight, the Thriller in Manila, as it's called. And his trainer, this is years afterwards, his trainer, without hesitation, instantaneously said, absolutely, we did the correct thing. And the reason is, I have seen 8 people die in the ring. I did not want it to be 9. With Joe Frazier, and that it was didn't take a second to think about it, and him and Haw, it was immediate. It is horrendous, and I think for a long time that has been an aspect of racism, to see black people get mauled and just beaten on in a boxing ring. Moving forward, I'm not sure how you could tell this, do a book like this that's supposed to be focused on the relationship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X and not talk about the rift between Minister Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, because that ends up being a significant factor in the friendship between Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X. So I think I'm not sure you could do this book and not touch on that. It just wouldn't work. Some of the things that, or you would be leaving, I think you would be leaving out, you know, key elements of what happened with their relationship. Some of the things that I noted where they're talking about Mr. Stokes being killed, infamous incident, another incident of police terrorism, where he quotes Chief William Parker in Los Angeles, where he says, Parker, who sometimes pronounced Negroes as Negras, I do that myself, my throwback. I prefer not the refinement. Let's just make it plain. If we're talking about racism, white supremacy, then let's use language that makes it plain, Negras, as opposed to trying to be quote-unquote dignified in how we talk about people classified as black. Let's see. One of the things that I do appreciate that has been highlighted repeatedly in this book, and I heard Johnny Smith, one of the white co-authors, talk about this book earlier this year, the surveillance that the Nation of Islam, Minister Malcolm, Muhammad Ali, that they were all under. Just tremendous surveillance and tapping phone calls and having people recording conversations and following them around and what are they doing and all of that. I mean, that is the system of white supremacy at work, still in play now. But where they said FBI agents listening in on Elijah Muhammad's phone calls learned that he had become alarmed about his young minister's restlessness. He worried that there was no one who could control Malcolm, not even the messenger himself. During a phone call, Elijah warned Malcolm just before he hung up, I hope Allah will keep you wise. Racist white supremacists, they look constantly to create conflict between non-white people. If there is conflict between non-whites, which there's going to be, they look for ways that they can strengthen, exacerbate that conflict so that it keeps our focus, time, and energy not on solving the problem, but squabbling, bickering with each other. That's why goals, tasks of counter-racism, minimizing conflict with other non-white people. And it just continues, or it says the FBI realized that if Elijah Muhammad's followers learned about his affairs, the hypocrisy could lead to the downfall of the nation. The Bureau's agents recommended using carefully selected informants who would plant the seeds of dissension through anonymous letters and or telephone calls. Specifically, they suggested mailing letters to his wife, Clara, even though she already knew about his trysts. This is the exact same thing that they did with Dr. Martin Luther King, trying to get him to commit suicide and cause all sorts of disruptions in their attempted marriage, talking about Coretta Scott King and Dr. Martin Luther King. You see a lot of the same tactics, and they did a lot of this with COINTELPRO members as well. And again, even hearing, just reading this book, it reminds me of Mr. Fuller when he talks about four-wallism. Just you're not going to be able to have some sort of organization. You're not going to be able to, quote-unquote, organize against racism, white supremacy. They have a myriad of ways of infiltrating, neutralizing any sort of organized attempt to deal with racism, white supremacy. One of the things that stood out, just word usage with the authors when he described some of Elijah Muhammad's sons, when Elijah Muhammad was having some health problems and some of his sons were getting greater influence, he used the term junta to refer to them. He says the junta enjoyed growing power and the benefits that came with it, and just the definition of a junta, J-U-N-T-A, a military or political group that rules a country after taking power by force. I didn't hear anything about any of Elijah Muhammad's family members, number one, being a military group, and then I certainly didn't hear anything where they, you know, got this power influence within the group by force, by beating people up, even though they did talk about the violence within the organization. But it didn't seem like there was any violence in them having growing influence within the organization with Elijah Muhammad's failing health. I thought that might have been an act of direct racism, white supremacy. Let's see. Again, informants, where they say on June 6th at a press conference, pressure intensified when Los Angeles Mayor Sam Yorty played a police informant recording of Malcolm X speaking at a Muslim gathering, referring to a plane crash where he talks about being elated that this plane crashed and killed these white people. Just, again, speaking about racism, white supremacy, you should just assume that whatever you're saying is going to be rebroadcast to the world. Racism, white supremacy, whenever you're talking about it, is nothing to play with. You want to be extremely serious anytime that you're talking to another person about racism, white supremacy, that that might be rebroadcast to the world, that it might be recorded, transcribed, anything. That's the attitude that you should have about racism, white supremacy, because it likely could happen. And frequently, people have gotten into all kinds of trouble about something that they said relating to racism, white supremacy. People have even been killed just for talking about this problem. Very important with regards to being serious. Let's see. There are a few other things. I definitely, the counter-violence, I had to touch on that. That's one of the things that I've noted consistently. When counter-violence comes up in terms of dealing with racism, white supremacy, somehow, some way, the focus invariably gets shifted back to black people. And that's one thing I certainly, you know, anyone who has suspicion about the way, the tone of this book, the word choice that the white authors, co-authors are using in constructing the book, it's valid. I understand totally. There are black people, Carl Evans is one I can think of, his book, The Judas Factor, who have written with the exact same tone and suspicion in the way that they talked about the Nation of Islam. Most of the information presented in this book I've heard before, and he quote, if you look at the references, he's quoting a lot of black people, Lewis Lomax, black author, black journalist, his writings about Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam. Certainly they have a lot of information from the FBI files and surveillance organizations who were tailing these groups, but a lot of black people had the exact same opinion. They're even quoting a lot of black people with some of the lines where they're talking about the Nation of Islam with regards to counterviolence. I've just seen that consistently where folks, black people, victims of white supremacy, where we can talk really tough about what we're going to do to racists and deal with them, and then we are a bit hesitant in dealing with them, but that hesitancy is not there in dealing with other black people. And that, I mean, is massively incorrect and something that, in my view, needs to be totally eliminated in how we go about dealing with the problem of racism, white supremacy. Beating on another black person is not going to solve any problems. And that played out, I think, both ways. I think Roz touched on it eloquently with regards to the violence, condoned violence against black females. That is just loathsome. It is nauseating to hear that sort of talk. I hear that even continued at some level today. Just reminded me first time, last time, that should not be condoned, accepted under any circumstances. Anybody talking that way, thank you for letting me know. I will make sure to keep my distance from you forever. All of that, in my opinion, it just makes it more and more difficult to solve this problem, because it makes it just, it keeps that conflict amongst the victims going, makes it more difficult to focus our time and energy on the problem, racist man, racist woman, racist child. One thing I did want to share, and then we'll see if other folks have commentary that they get in. One of our listeners, investors, there is another book on Muhammad Ali that I contemplated reading. This one is a little older. It is The Greatest, My Own Story by Muhammad Ali. Now, this is done with a white co-author. This book is a little bit longer, but it has a lot of interesting information. It might be one that folks want to check out if you have the time, energy, if you are just interested in knowing more about Muhammad Ali. But the person wrote in, they said, this is an excerpt from Muhammad Ali's autobiography that I'm currently reading. I thought you all might find this passage interesting and a lesson to those black people who lash out at other black people who speak incorrectly about racism. This is Muhammad Ali when he was Cassius Clay and had just won his gold medals at the Olympics and returned to his hometown. So all this is from the book. The mayor introduced me. Cassius is a typical Louisville product, he said. Our next world champion. The visitors applauded. Y'all hear what Cassius told that old Russian in Rome? The mayor was warming up. Read about that. This old Russian had the nerve to ask our boy how things were for Negroes in America. Go ahead, Cassius. Tell him. Don't be shy. I saw what was coming. A remark I'd made in Rome, one I regretted, but the mayor went on. He brushed off that Russian reporter like dirt. Tell him, Cash. Why, Cassius stood up tall. Look here, commie. America is the best country in the world, including yours. I'd rather live here in Louisville than in Africa, because at least I ain't fighting off no snakes and alligators and living in mud huts. He sure told him. He put his arm around me. He's our own boy, Cassius, our next world champion. Anything you want in town's yourn. You hear that? I heard him. And I heard something else inside me that turned over in shame. Of all things I said at the Olympic Village, this remark was the most quoted in newspapers and magazines, on TV and radio, and caught up and repeated month after month. And the instant I made it, I felt I had gotten caught up in some big white net. I had never given that answer, the white reporters. I had given the answer the white reporters who were listening wanted to hear a black athlete say. I knew nothing of Russia and little of Africa except what I'd seen in Tarzan movies. Yet the effect of my answer had been brought home to me my first day in Louisville. A young Nigerian approached me as I was talking with some friends and asked if I'd been quoted correctly. When I acknowledged that I had, he said, I thought we were brothers. You don't understand. I never met him before or since, but his sadness shook me, and I knew I had been slanted in the wrong direction. Later, when I did travel many times to Africa, I was even more ashamed that I had grown up so brainwashed about the history and life of the people I descended from. Most of the Africans I met and mingled with were far better educated than me. Many spoke 5 and 6 languages, and all spoke English better than I did. I saw modern cities, met talented, artistic people, and got to know something of the culture and contributions Africa had made in the ancient and modern world. I learned how Europe and America had robbed, raped, and enslaved its people for centuries and were still plundering and draining its wealth. This is page 62, The Greatest, My Own Story, by Muhammad Ali. It does have a white co-author. I thought that was a phenomenal passage and certainly something to keep in mind when we feel the hankering to attack another victim of racism for how they are responding to racism, white supremacy. I'm sure each and every non-white person on this line could look back over their life and times and say, wow, this was a moment where I might have done something that I regret, might have done something that I would not do now, certainly would have responded differently if I had better information. I will pause there. Other folks have comments that they wanted to make sure they get in. We have about 10 minutes before we get to the next audio segment. Any other comments folks want to make sure they get in?
Yes, I did. When Thomas was talking about the issues within the Nation of Islam, I have a very good friend from New Jersey who actually has family that's in the NOI. She was in the NOI as a youngster as well. She's an older sister, and she actually did confirm for me that some of the things that they're talking about here actually did happen. The mosque that she used to go to was the mosque in Newark, New Jersey, and she said they used to call that the ghetto mosque because there was so many people. That was like the vernacular term within the nation at that time for that mosque. First, because some of the people conspired to kill Malcolm X were from that particular temple, and then also just the sorts of things that they discussed as far as the violence that was mitigated by NOI members towards other NOI members. She also saw and heard about those things firsthand. So I just wanted to put that out there. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. If someone wanted to view it for themselves, I believe there was a part in the just previous book reading about the Los Angeles Nation of Islam versus LAPD. It was a rally that Malcolm was a guest speaker at. I believe that they also talked about that rally. Also, you can see excerpts of that on YouTube. It's quite popular, and they have it in pieces. You have to kind of like know what I believe it's captioned as such on it. But if someone wanted to actually see excerpts from it, one of his famous photographs is holding up that picture of the Nation of Islam member that was on the autopsy slab, with the infamous Y cut that they put in our bodies after doing an autopsy. He has that photograph of that, and he's holding it up while he's making a speech to an audience in New York, I believe. But the LA rally / speech is also advertised. It's black and white, but it's very, very clear, and very audible. As I mentioned before, it actually kind of like made certain members in the administration of the Nation of Islam concerned. From what I've heard from some of the callers, I have a personal family member, my father, who was in the Nation of Islam during the 60s, and they had problems such as I'm putting a short meaning to it. Bullying was probably much more than bullying, as far as that concerned, with the newspapers and that sort of thing. That was an issue during that time. Also, Malcolm X's name could not be mentioned after he was assassinated. couldn't be mentioned. But that's all I have for right now. Thank you.
Anything else folks wanted to make sure they get to before we get to the second audio segment? Folks have any, this stood out to me where it said when Cassius Clay early in his career, when he's going to some of these, the mosques and hearing what the Nation of Islam speakers have to say, Elijah Muhammad, Minister Malcolm X, where they write, this is at the end of chapter four, if a black writer recognized Cassius Clay at one of the rallies or noticed his picture in Muhammad Speaks, or a white writer caught wind of him shaking hands with Malcolm X, it could have ended his career, and apparently no one said anything. Any thoughts, theories on why this was kept hushed? Because, I mean, literally, this could have ended. This was way before he had his title opportunity against Sonny Liston. Any thoughts on why this was kept quiet successfully?
Well, possibly people like Howard Cosell benefited from Muhammad Ali. And at that time, Cassius Clay. And I'm pretty sure it was some other sports officials who saw that this young black male, as charismatic as he was, you could actually exploit his personality, marketable not so much in the thought of commercial from that standpoint, but from the standpoint of I'm getting an interview of him. You know, and so from there, it might have been some kind of desire not to expose that particular episode of his life. Jeff, a thought?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
These was black and white reporters that were hush-hush, so to speak, about Cassius Clay's involvement with the NOI?
Well, they're not naming anyone or saying specifically that, you know, black reporters or white reporters saw this. They're just saying that the Muhammad Speaks publication, they had a photograph of Minister Malcolm and Muhammad Ali in the publication, and, you know, they have hundreds of thousands of this newspaper, so someone could have seen this, black or white, or at the rallies, at the mosques where he attended, that a black person could have seen him and said, hey, Muhammad Ali was, you know, or excuse me, Cassius Clay at the time, was at this rally and made a big to-do about it, and that didn't happen. If it did, it could have ruined his career. Just thoughts on why that seemed to have successfully been kept quiet.
Yeah, it sounds to me like his career was being protected. Sounded like he was being protected. And to touch on something that was spoke on, I think it was Ross who read the text about people. The niggas just like to beat up on the niggas. They don't like to touch the white people, paraphrasing. And it sounds like to me, like when he was reading the text, I had the thought, Elijah Muhammad, it made me question Elijah Muhammad's position. The things that he was doing, like you got all your soldiers ready to go. And then the head like, nah, you know, we ain't going to do that. And then it seems like that, people started leaving because certain people, didn't have on the rose colored glasses anymore. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I think just like the previous caller and the firefighter in Florida said, I truly believe that they were watching his career and protecting him. The reason why is because white people are very forward-thinking, and to kind of mirror what the firefighter in Florida said, I'm pretty sure they saw the potential for him to really become a major person as far as in sports, and they wanted to capitalize off of that. And I'm sure the controversy that would come with him being a Nation of Islam member, especially during that time when the Nation of Islam was seen as such a powerful, subversive
quote-unquote black supremacist group, that white people are forward-thinking, and I'm pretty sure that they knew that once he reached public notoriety on a much higher level, that him being in the Nation would bring even more viewership to the media or readership to those newspapers, and they wanted to do that, use him for those purposes. It kind of reminds me of today how this, like a lot of people, especially our folks, black folks, victims of white supremacy, will do things that are just totally self-effacing and self-denigrating to get our quote-unquote 15 minutes of fame. And, you know, white people will always give you a platform if you're making yourself and basically subsequently all black people look like what they played us up to be over time. So I just think that it's just really something that they were just forward-thinking, and they saw they could really capitalize off of this man in a way that they knew they wouldn't be able to if they allowed his career to be ruined by this information getting out to the public too soon. And timing, just the impeccable time of how white people are. I remember you brought up, Gus, the fact that they'll have things against people and hold them sometimes years in order to use it strategically in a moment where they can capitalize off of it. And I believe that this was the same situation with Muhammad Ali. Thank you.
The caller at 3637, did you have comments you were going to share as well, 3637?
Yes, I did. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Hello, everyone. Yeah, that the career of Muhammad Ali, it was protected, because if we remember from the beginning of the book, it was some rich, racist, white supremacist people from Kentucky financing him. I don't know if they stopped having dealings with him or were they still involved with him. But, yeah, that sounds about right, because in the beginning he was being financed by some rich, racist, white supremacists in Kentucky there. And I just wanted to point that out.
Right on. We will. I think we got all the folks who dialed in. Yes, sir.
I was just going to say, yeah, I think they do that practice today as well. It'll be athletes that some of them protected. I mean, just look at baseball, what they did with hiding the fact that they was all taking steroids for years, and so it didn't benefit them anymore. They definitely have the power to protect someone, and that was probably something they thought was gonna, that's gonna pass. You know, he's into that stupid stuff. You know, but we get some money out of it, and I don't know if that was the guy said, the soldiers was ready to go and the leader didn't want, he wanted to hold back. And I mean, if the soldiers would have went, it would have just been a bloodbath. I mean, maybe he was the only one thinking with common sense. Like, this is the 1950s and 60s. I mean, they just shot, seven people in Los Angeles already. I mean, it would have just been a total wipeout of the Nation of Islam if anything like that would have happened.
Right on. We will pause there. If folks have additional commentary that they did not get a chance to get in, just make a note, and we should have ample time once the second audio segment concludes for you to share anything. If it relates to the first audio segment or what's going to come up in the second section, we will hear more about Sonny Liston. Pause for Michael Brown. I guess there will be lots of other victims in St. Louis, Missouri, but Sonny Liston absconds from Arkansas to St. Louis, Missouri to get away from his abusive father. That has been a theme in the book as well. Abusive black fathers. Context of white supremacy. This is Blood Brothers, the fatal friendship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X, Randy Roberts, and Johnny Smith. Audio segment number two.
In the pen, he learned valuable skills that saved his life. Father Alois Stevens, the Catholic chaplain and athletic director at Jeff City, saw in Liston a big, ignorant, pretty nice kid who seemed perfectly suited for the boxing ring. He was, Stevens remembered, the most perfect specimen of manhood I had ever seen. At 6'1.5" tall and over 200 pounds, with thick legs, broad shoulders, long, heavily muscled arms, and enormous hands, he had a heavyweight's build. He was also graceful on his feet and had remarkably quick hands. Frank Mitchell, one of Liston's early managers, witnessed the same quickness when Sonny suddenly reached down and scooped a live pigeon off the sidewalk. If ever there was a case of biology being destiny, Liston was it. After serving just over 2 years of his sentence, Sonny was paroled in October 1952 to the custody of Father Stevens, as well as Monroe Harrison and Frank Mitchell, two men with ties to the St. Louis boxing scene. Under their direction, Liston strung together a few amateur titles, and then, in 1953, turned professional. An immediate success, by early 1956, he had won 15 of 16 fights. Once again, his problems came from outside the ring, among the unwholesome influences in the dark streets and back alleys of St. Louis. Harrison sold his management share of Liston's contract in 1955, but even before then, John Vitale had become Sonny's undercover manager. Reputed to be the leader of the St. Louis crime family, Vitale undoubtedly received a piece of Liston's ring earnings and employed him when Sonny was not engaged in his primary profession. Liston did odd jobs for Vitale's construction business. Sometimes he served as his chauffeur. Other times, he broke legs and cracked heads for his boss. Although Sonny's face was impassive, it conveyed the pain of his life. But his face also suggested something even more sinister, something buried just beneath the surface of white American culture, struggling to crack the crust. Poet Leroy Jones, after 1968, a Mary Baraka, described the implicit threat of the boxer. Sonny Liston was the big black Negro in every white man's hallway, waiting to do him in, deal him under, for all the hurts white men have been able to inflict on his world. As a result of his various activities and his implicit threat, the police constantly harassed Liston, and he was arrested as often as he fought professionally. On May 5, 1956, he got into an argument with a cop over a parking ticket. The confrontation escalated, ending with Patrolman Thomas Mello lying on the ground with a broken knee and a gash over his left eye, and Sonny trotting away with the officer's Colt 38 service revolver. Soon arrested and convicted, he was sentenced to 9 months in the city workhouse. Liston walked out of prison in the fall of 1957, but he was far from rehabilitated. He continued to run afoul of the law, and it seems probable that St. Louis policemen targeted him for special harassment. Soon, he was advised to leave the city. As Sonny recalled the episode, a police captain said, "If you don't, they're going to find you dead in an alley." So Liston left, resettled in Philadelphia, and reappeared in the ring under new management. His career was to some degree always controlled by mobsters, but by 1958, he had become the special project of the leading gangsters in the boxing business. There were layers to his management, with each stratum more secretive and powerful than the one below. On paper, Joseph Pep Baroni was his manager, but he was merely a front man for Philadelphia gangster Frank Blinky Palermo, who in turn took orders from Frankie Carbo. And with such influential friends behind him, Liston's career bounded forward. Suddenly, he was able to get fights with leading contenders, and by spring 1960, he was the top-ranked fighter in the division. His problem, however, was that he had become a focal point for critics who assailed the sport. From the late 1940s to the early 1960s, two men from two organizations had control of prize fighting. The first was initially a legal corporation organized in 1949. Controlled by James Dugan Norris, a Chicago businessman, the International Boxing Club, IBC, soon acquired a stranglehold on the promotion of major fights in the United States. Within a few years, it was a monopolistic octopus of the first order, and in 1957, a federal court ruled it so and ordered it broken up. 2 years later, it was disbanded. But like Liston's managers of record and undercover managers, James Norris was little more than a frontman for Frankie Carbo, whose power was virtually absolute, his dictates tantamount to royal commands. Virtually every major boxing manager and promoter worked to some degree with Carbo. His henchmen gave them no choice, and many fighters owed their careers to him, as Sonny Liston did. Carbo's influence began to wane in the late 1950s when he was arrested for federal income tax violations and sentenced to 25 years in prison. But Liston's career continued to flourish. Sports writers debated whether Patterson should give him a title shot, and whether he was a reformed man or still a back-alley thug, but none questioned that he was the most fearsome, most qualified contender in the division. Even President John F. Kennedy offered an opinion. In January 1962, at a White House meeting with Patterson, he suggested that Floyd not risk his crown against Liston. Patterson, however, was an honorable man who believed in redemption and second chances. Liston's life, he thought, was not so different from his. Both had bad beginnings and had moved into petty crime, only Floyd had received help, and Sonny had not. A devout Catholic, Patterson believed, "There but for the grace of God go I." Liston had committed crimes, gone to prison, paid his debt, and was now a fellow professional. No matter what Patterson's manager, Customato, sports writers, the NAACP, or the President of the United States thought, Liston had earned a chance to fight for the heavyweight title. Patterson fought Liston on September 25, 1962, under the lights at Comiskey Park in Chicago. It may have been the most talked and written about fight since the 1938 rematch between Joe Louis and Max Schmeling. It was covered by some 200 sports writers and a distinguished collection of novelists and essayists. Less than half a year after the death of Benny the Kid Perrette, they seemed to have come to write boxing's obituary. Norman Mailer had been sent by Esquire, James Baldwin by Nugget, and A.J. Liebling by The New Yorker. They were joined by Gay Talese, Nelson Algren, Bud Schulberg, Gerald Kirsch, and a busload of others. Surveying the array of talent, Liebling judged that it was like one of those highly intellectual pourparlers on a Mediterranean island, and suspected that, placed before typewriters, the accumulated novelists could have produced a copy of the Paris Review in 42 minutes. Yet the great struggle to determine which black man would represent the aching hopes and smoldering resentments of black Americans was not much of a contest at all. Instead of staying away from Liston, Patterson advanced toward him, trying to slip under what he thought was a slow jab and get close enough to land hooks to Sonny's body and face. But Sonny banged away with several hard hooks. Then he pushed a left to the head that sent Patterson sprawling onto the ropes. As Floyd bounced awkwardly off the ropes, Liston hit him with a left, a grazing right, and a devastating left hook that half lifted him off the ground. Patterson dropped to the canvas like a man who had slipped on ice, landing clumsily and rolling onto his back. Immediately, he maneuvered to his side, managing to elevate his torso slightly. There, he hesitated, shaking his head a few times in an attempt to regain his senses. Finally, he struggled to his feet. But it was too late. Referee Frank Sikora had counted him out at 2:10 of the first round. Summarizing the match, Gilbert Rogan reconfigured a Churchillian phrase, writing, "Never have so many paid so much to see so little." Spectators trudged out of Comiskey Park and theaters across the country, feeling disappointed, if not cheated. Liebling insisted that Patterson was a nice young man, kind to children, socially conscious, conscientious about his work, who did not quit. He just got licked. As for Floyd, he slunk out of Comiskey wearing a fake beard and mustache and drove through the early morning hours to New York. Still in disguise the next day, he went to the airport and bought a ticket to Madrid, where he stayed for a week or so, limping through the poorer section of town like an old man and eating soup, because, he said, that was what an old man would eat. Liston, who had once been a tool of mobsters and who kept running afoul of the police, was the new title holder. Although Sonny claimed that he planned to prove that he could be a good and decent champion, few insiders believed he could change his old habits. Boxing, some thought, was dying. The death of Perrette and the ascendancy of Liston seemed to seal its fate. In the minutes before the Patterson-Liston fight, boxing's two most vocal practitioners were introduced in the ring. The younger man received little attention. He was, after all, still lightly regarded as something of a comic novelty. "Ladies and gentlemen, heavyweight contender Cassius Clay," the announcer intoned. Cassius swung through the ropes, wearing a black tie, and shouting something. "As insolent as ever," James Baldwin commented dismissively. In Norman Mailer's 20,000-word article on the match, Clay did not even rate a mention. Of more interest to the novelists and fans was the stylish veteran Archie Moore, elegant in a black opera cape and carrying a cane. He entered the ring with the panache of a stage performer, twirling his cape with the flair of a magician. At that moment, when so much talk was about the death of boxing, neither Cassius nor Archie seemed in a position to change the sport's fate. For all his boasting and predicting, Clay was still young, a barely discernible figure on the distant horizon, commented Arthur Daly. His record was padded with no-name boxers, over-the-hill fighters, and other assorted paper tigers. And Archie Moore was clearly a boxer on his way out of the sport. Like Liston, his birth date was a mystery. But whether it was 1913 or 1915, it was definitely during Woodrow Wilson's first term. As he neared his 50th birthday, the fact that he was still boxing and articulate seemed miraculous. He was a monument to the sport's past, not a cornerstone of its future. For Angelo Dundee, old, out-of-shape Archie, a former light heavyweight champion who had been stripped of his crown by sanctioning bodies, was both an ideal stepping stone and a potentially lucrative draw. Cassius began the build-up for a match, minutes after he knocked out Alejandro Lavarante. After slipping out of the ring, he noticed Moore sitting near ringside. Pointing a finger, he scowled, shouting, "You're next, old man! Moore will fall in four!" A few days later, Moore responded, "That kid's got a lot to learn, and I'm afraid the old professor is going to have to teach him. I've discovered a few chinks in his armor." Moore understood Clay's showmanship, but he was also keenly aware of the young man's many talents. Cassius had all of the outrageous fortunes of youth: speed, strength, endurance, and the firm belief in his own destiny. Against those advantages, Archie possessed only experience, guile, and a reputation supported by yellowing newspaper clippings. He no longer had the skills to compete with the best in the young man's sport, but he needed money. By the fall of 1962, with shrinking television ratings and other boxing cards drawing meager audiences, money seemed to be fleeing the sport. Even the Liston-Patterson match was a bit of a financial disappointment, drawing fewer than 20,000 fans to Comiskey and a closed-circuit audience 40% below expectations. With these grim facts in mind, promoters Cal and Aileen Eaton took a cautious approach by staging the Clay-Moore match in the Los Angeles Sports Arena rather than the larger Coliseum, and initially excluded live radio, television, and closed-circuit theater broadcasts. That was before Clay and Moore began drumming up interest. Clay's routine produced good copy, but while he had once been good-natured and humorous, he had now turned edgy and mean. Archie Moore was a beloved and respected West Coast boxer, the sport's elder statesman, and Cassius treated him like a two-bit bum. When the two appeared together on a half-hour television show called The Great Debate, Clay came off not so much as an occasional scene-stealer, but as a serial scene-mugger. As soon as Moore said, "Good evening," Cassius began a spontaneous filibuster, drowning out virtually everything Archie tried to say. Moore considered himself a thoughtful speaker and conversationalist, but it was difficult to engage a rabble-rouser and a shouter. "Don't humiliate yourself," Moore finally said. "Our country depends on its youth. Really, I don't see how you can stand yourself." As the interest in the bout mounted, the Eatons decided that the fight had blockbuster potential and maneuvered to increase revenues. Although they maintained a television blackout for the L.A. area, they did contract for a 55-theater closed-circuit broadcast adding a potential seating capacity of 200,000. By the night of the match, Clay's predictions of his drawing power were confirmed. The fight sold out the Los Angeles Sports Arena. 16,200 spectators paid a total of $182,599, both indoor records for California. Closed-circuit venues in New York, San Francisco, Boston, San Diego, Seattle, and Louisville also sold out, adding nearly another $250,000 in revenues. In a year when prize fighting was under attack and revenues were falling off a cliff, the Clay Moore bout was the glittering exception. The Louisville Lip, the mouth that roared, was a certifiable cash cow. The term Battle of the Ages, as it was called, was accurate in only its most literal sense. In 2 years as a professional, Cassius had filled out into a sleek heavyweight of just over 200 pounds and had entered his prime. His face creased with age. Moore was old and flabby, with a welted scar on his stomach that looked like it was from some primitive operation. Jimmy Cannon wrote that Archie seemed to be drowning in his own fat. Before the fight began, Clay danced lightly in his corner, bouncing gracefully and rolling his shoulders. Moore managed a few knee bends, the limbering calisthenics of an old man getting ready to jog around the block. Cassius had predicted Moore in four, and nothing about the appearance of the two indicated that the match would not follow the young man's boast. And so it went. As Al Buck of the New York Post summarized, a 20-year-old youth beat up a tired 50-year-old veteran of too many fights. Ancient Archie was fat and slow. He had nothing left. Once in the ring, Clay demonstrated his superiority. From the beginning of the contest, Cassius circled around Archie, who tried to protect himself with his familiar cross-arm defense. He threw an unusual number of punches for a heavyweight, repeatedly bouncing them off the top of Moore's head. Archie ducked and weaved, avoiding many of the shots, but not nearly enough. "Clay missed 100 punches," said Moore's trainer, Dick Sadler. "But he threw 200. The punches were not as heavy as Liston's, but they had a cumulative effect. "His speed was too much for me," Moore recalled. "You see, he had a style. He would hit a man a lot of times around the top of the head, and if you hit the top of a man's head, you shake up his thought pattern." By the fourth round, Moore was as disoriented as a man who had just stepped off of a tilt-a-whirl. "His face," commented Gilbert Rogan, "was as red as a boy who has been in a jam pot, and his body was covered with traces of whiplash punches." Quickly, with a flurry of shots, Clay knocked him down, sending Archie's mouthpiece skipping across the ring like a smooth rock across a pond. Dancing, raising his arms, and admiring his handiwork, he remained above Moore until the referee pushed him to a neutral corner. Moore got up at the count of eight, but Clay knocked him down a second time. Again, he struggled off the canvas, and once more, Clay knocked him down. The referee waved his arms, signaling the end of the contest. Sitting at ringside, watching the fight with a benign smile, Sonny Liston seemed gratified with the results. Clay had demonstrated that he could fill an arena, as well as shown Liston that he lacked real power. After the bout, Cassius had pointed at Liston, shouting, "You're next! I'll fix you in 8 rounds! If you can go 8 seconds with me, I'll give you the fight," Liston answered. By the end of 1962, boxing was creaking back to life. "Clay saved sad year for boxing," headlined the Los Angeles Times. It had been an awful year. Perrette had died. Leverante was dying. Moore and Sugar Ray Robinson were limping toward the ends of their careers, and Liston and his gang had captured the heavyweight title. But in a series of matches in Los Angeles, Clay had revealed an ability to attract spectators. He seemed, as he often proclaimed, the savior of the sport. Boxing savior, he was. He had the golden touch, the Gorgeous George magic that put customers in seats. He displayed his special talent in November in Los Angeles against Moore, and then repeated it in January in Pittsburgh against Charlie Powell, an exceptional athlete, but not proficient enough a boxer to challenge Clay. A week after his 21st birthday, Cassius knocked him out in the third round. Yet in sub-zero weather, more than 11,000 fans, a local indoor record, paid to boo the undefeated boxer. It was just before the Powell match that, in a conversation with sports writer Mort Sharnick, Cassius revealed a different side of himself. Without confessing his ties to the Nation of Islam, he began talking about spirituality. He wondered why he couldn't have visitations from God. Sharnick recalled, he was saying that Moses spoke to God and the prophets spoke to God, and why couldn't he speak to God? It was a curious observation. Sitting in a room in Pittsburgh, preparing to fight a powerful boxer whom he had dubbed Frankenstein, Cassius seemed more interested in his relationship with God. I had the feeling he sensed he was a special vessel, that he might be ordained for special things, the writer recalled. Sharnick did not understand the source of Clay's power. He was unaccustomed to athletes speaking so openly about deeply personal matters. But Sharnick had not spoken so intensely with Malcolm X, for whom profound religious conversations were common. Malcolm knew a man who did speak with God, and in the months since he had met Clay, he had followed the boxer in newspapers, watching his career blossom. It was time, Malcolm had decided, to visit Cassius, attend one of his fights, and talk about a new message. Chapter 6. Apollo. Coffee is the only thing I like integrated. Malcolm X. I want to integrate my coffee. I don't want to drink it black. Think I'll have my coffee weak this morning. Cassius Clay. Elijah Muhammad's children distrusted Malcolm. They were certain that he coveted the messenger's throne. In early 1963, they became especially concerned about their father's chronic bronchial asthma. If his health deteriorated, they wondered, who would lead the nation? Thin as a scarecrow, weighing only 125 pounds, Elijah couldn't shake a persistent cough. He was so weak that he sent a telegram to Chicago informing his followers that he could not attend the annual Savior's Day convention, the holiest day in the Nation of Islam. In his place, Malcolm would serve as Master of Ceremonies, an appointment that drove an even deeper wedge between him and Elijah's children. In late February, on the eve of the convention, Malcolm met with Elijah's son Wallace to discuss the most urgent problem in the nation, the messenger's affairs. Recently paroled after serving more than a year in prison for draft evasion, Wallace arrived in Chicago, stunned by rumors of his father's infidelities. He was shocked to see two women standing out in the cold on his father's lawn, holding babies that they claimed belonged to the messenger. The women said that they would not leave until Elijah acknowledged the children. Wallace knew the women, he said, and shortly thereafter confirmed to Malcolm that the children belonged to Elijah. During the convention, Elijah's children complained that Malcolm had taken over. When they asked to hear Wallace speak on stage, Malcolm said that there was not enough time for him to address the assembly. The tension escalated when Malcolm called a family meeting and announced his plan to confront numerous problems harming the nation. Undercover FBI agents reported that the family was especially resentful of Malcolm's attempts to advise and tell the family what to do. When his children grumbled about Malcolm's lingering presence in Chicago, Elijah dismissed their complaints, reminding them that Malcolm was responsible for boosting us up throughout the country. On other occasions, though, he admitted that he had always known that Malcolm would breach his trust and that he had no business discussing a family affair, his affairs. On March 10th, Elijah telephoned his son-in-law, Raymond Sharif. Raymond explained that Malcolm had not yet left Chicago and planned to make more public appearances later in the week. Elijah gave Raymond an order, tell Malcolm to go home and check on Betty. During the flight back to New York, Malcolm mulled over his conversations with Elijah's former secretaries. The women told him that Muhammad had said that he was the best minister in the nation, but that his ambition made him dangerous. Someday, Muhammad predicted, Malcolm would leave him. It was only a matter of time. Listening to the women, Malcolm learned that while Elijah praised him to his face, he was tearing me apart behind my back. Just thinking about Elijah's words made it hard to breathe. He felt betrayed. What Elijah did not know was that Malcolm already had plans to return to New York City so that he could attend the biggest prize fight of the year, a bout involving Cassius Clay. Since meeting Malcolm 9 months earlier, Cassius had attended more Muslim meetings, ingratiating himself with the Harlem minister. But no one outside the nation suspected that Malcolm had taken an interest in the young boxer. Elijah himself had no idea that Malcolm planned to sit ringside at Madison Square Garden during his next match. When a reporter asked Malcolm what he thought about prize fighting, he called it a racket. "Commercialized sport is the pleasure of the idle rich," he said. "Rich white men exploited poor men who beat up other poor men. The vice of gambling stems from it." No one appreciated this better than Big Red. He was, after all, a product of the street, a former sport who had lived the life of urbanity, gambling, and vice. It was the same world occupied by boxers, promoters, and hustlers who ran the fight game. It was a world of backroom deals, late-night escapades, and easy women. Malcolm nevertheless understood the cultural power wielded by champions. He had matured during the age of Joe Louis, the most admired and talked about black man of the 1930s. He recalled that in 1937, when Louis defeated heavyweight champion James Braddock, all the Negroes in Lansing, like Negroes everywhere, went wildly happy with the greatest celebration of race pride our generation had ever known. Every Negro boy old enough to walk wanted to be the next Brown Bomber. Malcolm recognized that, unlike Joe Louis, Cassius Clay refused to let white men control him. The brash young boxer had shown an independent side, an unwillingness to play by the white man's rules, asserting his freedom in the world of boxing. Sometimes he defied Angelo Dundee's instructions and ignored his advisors in the Louisville sponsoring group. Many white fans and sports writers who disapproved of his gloating in the ring would have preferred that he stand in the corner after he won a match, like Louis, gracious and expressionless. The fact that Cassius spoke his mind, attended Muslim meetings, and reached out to the minister, risking his career, convinced Malcolm that he was not the white man's puppet. Perhaps, Malcolm thought, he could mold him like a lump of clay, sculpting him into a new kind of black champion, a champion of black nationalism. But to do that, to become the heavyweight champion of the world, the Muslims' champ, and a powerful voice carrying Malcolm's message, Clay had to beat Doug Jones. Cassius was in New York City to sell tickets. Scheduled to box third-ranked heavyweight contender Doug Jones in Madison Square Garden on March 13, 1963, he faced a daunting promotional task. Jones was a very good boxer, small for a heavyweight, though a fine defensive fighter with solid punching power. He had won 21 of his 25 professional matches, and his 3 losses and 1 draw had been by decision to boxers of his caliber. Competent and workmanlike in the ring, he was undistinguished outside the ropes, and he most emphatically was not a drawing card. Cassius had to do the talking for both men, a task he attacked with relish. On Sunday, February 3rd, he kicked off his campaign with an appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show, a popular variety program. Once a sports writer and still a boxing fan, Sullivan regularly introduced boxers on his show and plugged upcoming matches. Sullivan tried to put the boxer at ease by asking him if he had a prediction for the Jones fight. "I understand that Jones likes to mix, but he must fall in 6, Cassius replied. "Suppose I were to box you, how far would I go?" the host asked. "Well, Ed, if you run, I'll have to cut it to 1. 1 round? No, 1 punch. Then, for a moment, Clay became nervous and misspoke. "I'm not just a musician in the ring. I'm not just a musician in the ring. I'm the same out of the ring." He meant to say that he was a magician in and out of the ring, and to prove his point, he took a blue scarf out of his pocket, waved it a few times, and presto, transformed it into a cane. Cassius loved magic, and his trick looked professional, winning instant applause from the audience. But what no one at the time realized, or would recognize for some time to come, was that his life had come to resemble his magic. A good magician makes you see what he wants you to see, concealing from your gaze what he wants to hide. He is like a great boxer who, as former light heavyweight champion Jose Torres once suggested, lies for a living. Champions and good fighters are champions and good fighters because they can lie better than the others. The first thing you learn in the gym is that you have to have a double personality if you are to become a good fighter. Torres understood that to reach a championship level, a boxer had to employ feints and fakes to make his opponent look at one hand when he was about to get hit with the other. Cassius, too, had a deceptive personality. At the beginning of 1963, Cassius's magic showed the world a buffoonish, loudmouth clown while hiding his growing relationship with Malcolm X and his inner feelings about race in America. In public, he shouted, "I am the greatest!" repeating doggerel and refining his Gorgeous George routine. In private, he attended Nation of Islam meetings and memorized the speeches of Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X. Inside Cassius Clay was Muhammad Ali. But for the moment, the magician kept that identity hidden. 2 days after appearing on The Ed Sullivan Show, Clay traveled to Albany, where the movement to abolish boxing in New York had collided with an army of boxers, baseball players, and journalists. Before a joint legislative committee conducting a hearing into the sport, they formed a line of defense against the politicians, moralists, and reformers out to ban the sweet science. "Boxing in New York was cleaner than anywhere else in the world," said Melvin Krulowich, the New York State Athletic Commission chairman. "Boxing is safer than baseball," judged Gil McDougald, former New York Yankee infielder. "Boxing is one area of the sports world where equal opportunity is granted to members of my race," commented James Hicks of the New York Amsterdam News, adding, "Negroes may not be accepted on the tennis courts of Forest Hills, but they are accepted as equals in the boxing ring." After almost a decade of close scrutiny and a year of hostile attacks, the sport seemed to be slowly rebounding from its lowest point. Dressed in a dark suit and bow tie, Cassius Clay lectured the committee on the history of pugilism. "Boxing is in the winter of its life now. In the time when there were great fighters like Dempsey and Joe Louis, nobody talked against it. When there are no great fighters, people lose interest." Boxing was like the march of the seasons. In the winter, things are cold, things are dead. Spring will come again, and so will summer. Clay himself was the warm breeze of spring, he made perfectly clear. "I am here to liven things up. On March 13th, I will be fighting in the garden, and it will be a total sellout." After answering a few of the committee's questions, Cassius concluded his testimony. "When he stepped down," journalist A.J. Liebling observed, "a faint odor of hubris, like lilac vegetal, lingered behind." The whiff of spring might have lingered in the committee room, but not Clay, who immediately departed the frigid weather of Albany for the sunshine of Miami. On the first leg of the trip, he rode a train back to New York City. Sitting alone, he stared out the window, looking up at the sky and attempting, it seemed, to see beyond the clouds into the mysteries of space. Growing restless and bored, he switched seats, moving across the aisle to sit next to Frank DeFord, a junior sports writer for Sports Illustrated, assigned to cover the hearings, on the off chance that anything of note took place. DeFord assumed that Clay would want to talk about his testimony, the fate of boxing, or his upcoming match against Doug Jones. But Cassius didn't want to discuss his career. Instead, he grabbed DeFord's notepad and pen and started drawing what looked like an elaborate solar system, with lines and circles indicating descending aliens and something or other about God. The sports writer knew nothing about the theology of the Nation of Islam. He had no idea that the boxer sitting 3 feet away from him was reciting what he had learned from Muslim ministers about the Day of Judgment. Listening to him, DeFord thought that this was just another one of his gimmicks, an amusing tale designed to provoke laughter. As Cassius continued lecturing, though, he realized that this was no joke. Clay sincerely believed this story about a mothership descending on Earth, saving the true believers. When they disembarked at Grand Central Terminal, DeFord packed his notepad in his briefcase, shaking his head at the very amusing but nutty story Clay had just told him. Later, when he returned home, he tore out the drawings of spaceships and tossed them into the trash. He did not realize that he had thrown away the best evidence that any sports writer had to prove that Cassius Clay had embraced the Nation of Islam. Later in the day, Cassius took another train to Miami, arriving late Friday night. The next day, he returned to the Fifth Street gym to begin training for Jones. As he sparred in the ring, Sonny Liston sauntered in to watch. Liston, who had also arrived on Friday, had come to town to train for his April 4th rematch in Miami with Floyd Patterson. Unconcerned about that fight, he planned to knock out Patterson even quicker than before. He decided to scout a future opponent.
"Get him out of here! That bum is spying on me!" Cassius yelled.
The comment prompted an exchange of insults.
"What have I got to spy on you for? You're no fighter!"
Sonny shot back, and then offered Cassius a job as his sparring partner. But Sonny was out of his league in the game of the dozens.
"You ain't so hot," Clay said. "I could leave both legs at home and beat you."
Sonny was nothing but a big ugly bear, he shouted, as he shifted to a more personal assault.
"Ugly! I hate him because he's so ugly. I'll murder the bum," he told everyone in the gym.
Then he began to climb through the ropes to get closer to the champion. Liston charged. Clay scrambled back through the ropes to the security of the ring. What had started good-naturedly as a publicity stunt had not gone well for Sonny, and he was angry.
"I'm not training for Patterson. I'm training for you," he fumed as he left the gym.
Clay smiled. It was a small, early victory in his campaign against Sonny Liston.
And that will do it for this week. We'll pick up there next week. We are kind of at the end of Chapter 6, moderately, almost. We'll pick up there next week for study session number 4, and we are more than a third of the way through the book, so we should probably only have, if I had to guess, maybe 5 sessions before we get to the end of the book. Might not be that much, but somewhere in the ballpark of 5 sessions before we are all done. Context of White Supremacy, the number to dial, 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-POUND. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-POUND. Press *6 if you would like to participate. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, you should be with us. Firefighter in New York, Roz Thomas, firefighter in Florida, sorry, firefighter in Florida, Roz Thomas in New York, and the caller at 0613. Feel free to chime in. Other folks, please do not wait till the last minute. Go ahead, get a hand up if you have observations, thoughts you would like to share. Feel free, folks.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this book is very interesting. I definitely see quite a bit of racism there, and it can really skate by you if you're not paying attention. So my proverbial antenna has been up throughout the reading, but it is a good read. On page 79, they write, "As a result of his various activities and his implicit threat, the police constantly harassed Liston, and he was arrested as often as he fought professionally. On May 5th, 1956, he got into an argument with a cop over a parking ticket. The confrontation escalated, ending with the patrolman Thomas Mello lying on the ground with a broken knee and a gash over his left eye, and Sonny trotting away with the officer's Colt 38 service revolver. Soon arrested and convicted, he was sentenced to 9 months in the city workhouse." And I just thought about how incredible the prison industrial complex was even back then for him to have gone to jail basically as often as he fought professionally. Also, the fact that he seemed I guess in this instance, had a penchant for fighting with the cop, reminded me of an incident with a young man I grew up with that used to run in a gang, and he was so in and out of prison so often, and sadly, his nickname was Gorilla, and he had actually beaten the cop senseless before, too, and actually said he preferred to be in prison than to be out because he wasn't used to being on the street. So he was so acculturated to being under greater confinement that he preferred that to living outside of greater confinement. So it's just very interesting just how powerful the prison industrial complex worked in his life in that way. Very, very sad and violent life, I would say. On the next, actually, two paragraphs down the same page, they write here, his career was to some degree always controlled by mobsters, but by 1958, he had become the special project of the leading gangsters in the boxing business. There were layers to his management, with each stratum more secretive and more powerful than the one below. On paper, Joseph Pat Baroni was his manager, and then he was merely a front man for Philadelphia gangster Frank Blinky Palermo, who in turn took orders from Frankie Carbo, and with such influential friends behind him, quote-unquote friends, Liston's career bounded forward. Suddenly, he was able to get fights with leading contenders, and by spring 1960, he was a top-ranked fighter in his division. And it's just that one paragraph really brings home how incredibly criminal like people are, and it just is almost like a shell company with all these layers that you have to dig through to get to the real person behind them. And then also they used him as an enforcer. Some other part of the text they discussed that, where he would go around brutalizing people, you know, basically for his white handlers. And that was very interesting, but they're always using us for those sorts of things. One of the areas where the author was practicing racism was on page 83, where they call Muhammad Ali a serial scene mugger. They write, I'll just read the one sentence. When the two appeared together on the half-hour television show called The Great Debate, Clay came off not so much as an occasional scene stealer, but as a serial scene mugger. As soon as Morsett Good Evening Cassius began a spontaneous filibuster drowning out virtually everything Archie tried to say. I'll stop there, but just the whole idea of name-calling him something like that, I find to be a really extensive act of racism that someone might see, or the average person might just see as him being descriptive, but he's practicing racism, white supremacy. Another section where he was practicing racism as well was where he said Cassius II had a deceptive personality. This is on page 91, excuse me. Cassius II had a deceptive personality. At the beginning of 1963, Cassius's magic showed the world a buffoonish, loudmouth clown while hiding his growing relationship with Malcolm X and his inner feelings about race in America. In public, he shouted, "I'm the greatest," repeating doggerel and refining his gorgeous George routine. In private, he attended Nation of Islam meetings and memorized the speeches of Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X. Inside, Cassius Clay was Muhammad Ali, but for the moment, the magician kept that identity hidden, absolutely practicing racism. The only reason he had to be deceptive is because of racism, white supremacy. If there was no racism, white supremacy, he could have been who he wanted to be publicly and not lose his career and potentially his life for aligning himself with the Nation of Islam and seeing something in them that drew him to them via Minister Malcolm X. So, again, the author is definitely practicing racism. He knows exactly what made him have to be deceptive, and it was racism, white supremacy. I'll give someone else a chance to speak. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Within this, the previous reading, the statement, Sonny Liston and his game. Wow. Very shrewdly, a example of how slick white people can practice racism. Totally switched the narrative around. I'm not going to compete as far as one victim of racism, white supremacists being mistreated on a level of another, but Charles Sonny Liston was a unfortunate example of a non-white black person being mistreated all through his life exploited, abused all through his life. He couldn't even read or write. Someone taught him how to sign his name. And all of a sudden, it went from these white people who are called gangsters, who control not only boxing, but control people within the known universe. It went from that to Sonny Liston and his gang. I can recall hearing that through the last reading, and I said to myself, "Wow!" And like the last caller was stating, you know, the various other little phrases that they stick in there, you know, here and there, you know, and if you're not paying attention, or focusing on white people, it'll throw you off, and you'll start thinking about something else. Unfortunately. The tactic is designed for us to focus on each other. Archie Moore was somewhat of a charismatic figure himself, in a different way, you know, just like everybody has different personality as far as that concerned. He did play in a movie of Huckleberry Finn, and I didn't read the book, but it was a black figure that was, I believe, a slave. Is that correct?
Little Jim.
I don't know. Yeah, that's what he played in the movie. I think it was a Walt. If I'm not mistaken, it was a Walt Disney movie. If I'm not mistaken, and that is in living color, as they used to say back in the day. That movie with him playing Nigger, what's his name again?
Nigger Jim.
Nigger Jim. Yeah, he played Nigger Jim. I mean, even the fighters, even the non-white black fighters was mistreated, because he was one example of a fighter being so good at the craft that they were refused to allow him to fight for the championship. So that's why he stayed. That's why he was in boxing for so long, because he didn't even get a chance for a title, Archie Moore, until he was like in his 30s. He had over 200 fights. He had over 200 fights. Over 100 of them ended in knockouts, with him knocking his opponent out. Like I said, I wouldn't regard it as a sport, but he was very good at fighting. That's for sure. But of course, we know by the time that he came up against at that time Cassius Clay, he was, you know, like in his 50s, so to speak. But I'm trying to think. It was something else. When it comes to my mind, I'll wait for my turn again. Thank you.
Other folks have comments? Other folks that had a hand up? Anything you wanted to get in? All right. Maybe they're waiting till later. Please don't wait till the last minute. If you have any comments, you want to make sure you get in. Where they started off, this is in chapter 5, The Winter of Boxing. When you're talking about Sonny Liston, where he would get into fights with enforcement officers, the documentary that I played a little bit at the beginning of the program, they had a term for that. They called it a Nixie fighter. This is the label that they would use for someone who would look to get in fights, conflicts with enforcement officers. Reminded me of Richard Williams, Serena Williams' father, Venus Williams' father. We read his book, Black and White, The Way I See It, where he talked about going to Chicago and looking to get in brawls with enforcement officials earlier in his life. This is before he had Venus and Serena. But it reminded me of that when I was reading that section where he has beaten up this enforcement officer and taken his gun. That is astounding. This is not ancient history. We're not talking about something, you know, 100 years ago. I mean, this is like 1960s. I am amazed that Sonny Liston lived to tell about this, particularly if he had a reputation for brawling with enforcement officers, that, you know, we're going to shoot this nigger on sight. I mean, black people are being killed left and right at this time anyway. To have someone who has a lengthy criminal record and a reputation for fighting cops, like, wow, that is amazing on many levels. Next one that I got, again, Michael Brown, I thought of it, where it says Liston walked out of prison in the fall of 1957, but he was far from rehabilitated. He continued to run afoul of the law, and it seems probable that St. Louis policemen targeted him for special harassment. That is the entire system of white supremacy, and I think that even goes back to the first section. I think it was Roz, where he was saying that the white authors, both suspected racists, Randy Roberts, Johnny Smith, that they might have been practicing white supremacy, at least in Roz's view, and I agree with quite a few of the points that you all, not just Roz, have pointed out, where in the first segment that we heard today, where Minister Malcolm was saying that when Mr. Stokes and the other members of the Nation of Islam, that they were beaten, brutalized, Mr. Stokes killed by the enforcement officers in California, that this was akin to being treated like Jews in Nazi Germany. And saying, oh, this inflammatory rhetoric. And then they come back and say that, well, it does look like the St. Louis police were targeting Sonny Liston for special harassment. Like, that sounds exactly like what Minister Malcolm was saying, and it's widespread. It's not even just anything like Sonny Liston just because he is particularly troublesome. This is black people in general. Long-running problem, not just in St. Louis, but worldwide. Again, Michael Brown. And I also will pause. I don't know if folks are familiar. One of the best documentaries that I have seen, it just happens to be about boxing, but one of the best documentaries that I've seen, one of the best films that I've seen that deals with white supremacy racism is Jack Johnson, Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson, who many people compare to Muhammad Ali. It's done by Ken Burns, who's the same white guy who did the film, the recent documentary on Jackie Robinson, which is also pretty good. Not segueing to talk about any of that because this is a point. But he did the documentary. We had his daughter, Sarah Burns, Ken Burns' daughter, on the program a while back. She did the book and documentary on the Central Park Five cowbell. But in that film on Jack Johnson, and they end by connecting Jack Johnson to Muhammad Ali, but in that film, one of the co-authors is present, and he talks quite a bit. It's like a 3.5-hour documentary that was on PBS, but he talks quite a bit. Johnny Smith is in that documentary, and he has some interesting insight. It's worth watching regardless, whether you want to see what the co-author of the book that we're reading has to say or not, whether you want to see his part in it, that's kind of irrelevant. It's really, really good. And if you are interested in the book that we've been reading, it might be something to just add to your studies to check out. It is amazing. I guarantee you that you will not be bored. Samuel L. Jackson narrates. Anyway, I thought that was significant. But back to the book. I got the part about Sonny Liston and the police. In that documentary, not the Jack Johnson one, in the documentary that we played at the beginning of the program, Sonny Liston, the champ nobody wanted, champion nobody wanted, it says, confirming what retired firefighter says, and I think they've said in the book, that this was an illiterate prize fighter, much like Joe Louis and many others, illiterate black heavyweight champion. His wife talks about teaching him how to read once they got together, and helping him so he could sign his name and do autographs and things of that nature, but just trying to make it seem as though he is an equal participant in this nefarious gangster activity. I mean, that is ridiculous. He died with nothing, poor and broke. The same story that we've heard over and over and over again, being manipulated, exploited, and cheated, raped, if you will, by these white gangsters, white mobsters. I think I've said that that's been a running theme in a lot of the books that we've talked about this year. The gangsters on the planet are all white. Everybody else is like a way distant runner-up. Nobody holds a card to the gangsterism that racist man, racist woman, racist child put down on this planet worldwide and get away with it clean. But she talks about that, how he was just dependent on them because he, a literate prize fighter, he could, you know, no schooling or anything, which is also racist to blame, but he was just dependent on them to do right by him so he'd have some money to take care of himself. She even talked that these gangsters bought their first house that he had. It wasn't him. It was they did it with the money that they had looted from him. This portion where they talk about even President Kennedy, Floyd Patterson, black male, the champion, Sonny Liston beat, that even John F. Kennedy offered an opinion in January 1962, a White House meeting with Patterson. He suggested that Floyd not risk his crown against Liston. They say the exact opposite in that documentary, that John F. Kennedy encouraged Floyd Patterson to fight Sonny Liston and to beat him, that this would be great. It would be great for the sport of boxing. It would be great to show, you know, it kind of projecting the quote unquote good Negro, responsible Negro image that they wanted to be demonstrated, displayed around the world or around the country, that he encouraged him to fight Sonny Liston. So that's a discrepancy between that documentary and the book that we have here. I totally agree with the assessment. I think retired firefighter Roz pointed out about with the authors when they say describe Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay at the time, as being a liar, as being deceptive. I think if you're an author, and Johnny Smith has written quite a few books, many of them talking about athletics, I'm pretty sure that he's skilled enough, and you have editors and what have you with these books, that they could have come up with a different way of describing this, Muhammad Ali not being able to reveal his true self in an environment saturated with racism, white supremacy, where he could have lost his entire career, encountered all sorts of violence. Anything could have happened to him at this time. There's no way that you can open up and just be tell racist anything. I'm even reminded, folks saw the film Hurricane Carter, about Reuben Carter, also a boxing black fighter, where he's being interviewed by the press, and they take things out of context and lie, and then ends up causing him a lot of problems. So, I mean, that's over and over again. In fact, Sonny Liston, his wife said the same thing, that he ended up having a really bad relationship with the white-dominated press because they would lie and take things out of context, that he would say one thing and they would take it and twist it around and say something else. So, I mean, if you have any intelligence at all, you're not going to share your innermost secrets and tell them everything. That's logic in an environment saturated by racism, and particularly when the master deceivers are whites, racist man, racist woman, to portray Muhammad Ali as a liar and then try to be coy about it and just say, oh, well, this is part of, you know, his dynamism as a fighter and as a pugilist. You know, he's so deceptive. And in fact, there's even a trope of this, and I think they even talk about it in Jack Johnson, the documentary that I mentioned, Unforgivable Blackness, where they would describe Jack Johnson as being deceptive because he was a really good defensive fighter, so he could move and dodge a lot of punches. They wouldn't say that he was a great and skilled defensive fighter. They would say, oh, it's something shiftless about him, or it's something. It would always be a way of describing you in a less than favorable light, where there's somehow even almost suggesting that there's something criminally nefarious about what it is that you're doing. And that's the same feeling that I got. You all articulated it well when you talked about that section. Let's see, the next section, this is from chapter six now, where during the Elijah Muhammad's children complained that Malcolm X had taken over. When they asked to hear Wallace speak on stage, Malcolm said that there was not enough time for him to address the assembly. The tension escalated when Malcolm called a family meeting and announced his plan to confront numerous problems harming the nation. Undercover FBI agents reported that the family was especially resentful of Malcolm's attempt to advise and tell the family what to do. I think that's hugely important. Again, in my view, that's been one of the main themes throughout the book in terms of FBI informants, FBI surveillance, NYPD surveillance, constant vigilance of racists on these black people, manipulating these conflicts, instigating these conflicts, looking to exacerbate if they can, reporting. White people are not ignorant about racism, white supremacy, particularly if you are a black person who is trying to get a better understanding of racism, white supremacy, and do about it. All eyes will be focused on you, and I'll pause there. Anything else folks wanted to make sure they got in? Any folks that haven't shared at all, did they have anything they wanted to get in before we get ready to conclude? I assume they're satisfied. Any of the other folks, retired firefighter, Roz, anyone else, anything they wanted to make sure they got in?
Yeah, I just wanted to...
Oh, you go first. I hope you go first, buddy.
I just wanted to say briefly, because I've read on Charles Sonny Liston,
and also have seen it on documentaries, very good documentaries on Charles Sonny Liston. He would be at the top of the list under this new term that's called racial profiling. Sonny Liston was quote unquote racial profiled in two major cities, St. Louis and I believe Philadelphia. To whereas I believe in Philadelphia, he was told, if we have to come upon you one more time, we're going to kill you. We're going to kill you. What, this is my theory. Being that Sonny Liston was a exploited employee of white gangsters, and at the same time, white gangsters are supported by law enforcement. They always have been. He was able to, that's probably one reason why he was able to do some things that would kill somebody else, to get killed doing. In other words, somebody within the police department would say, hey, get your nigger, for we have to kill him, talking to whoever the gangster is in that particular city. And in turn, eventually what took place, because things were getting so hot for him in those two places, that eventually his place of residence was at the home city of the person who basically had total control over him. I forgot the white male's name. And subsequently, that he actually died in the house that they gave him, and was there for probably about 3 or 4 days, to where his body was smelling when they finally came upon, you know, he was, you know, in the house. But that's just my theory on that. But he definitely was, I mean, personally exploited and used up till the day he died. That's all I have to say.
Yes, I just wanted to chime in. Yeah, when you brought up the fact that he knocked out the cop and stole his gun, that was crazy, because I actually had I used to run the street with when I was in high school. He was Puerto Rican from the Bronx, and he actually did the same thing, knocked the cop out on the train, took his gun, and he was on the run for about 2.5 weeks before he was caught, and they swarmed his apartment when he came back to the Bronx from hiding out in Pittsburgh. They swarmed his apartment like the spot. So you're absolutely right, and even the guy I used to run with, he was lucky that he didn't get shot for doing that. But, yeah, definitely. The other thing I wanted to touch on, too, was the Jack Johnson documentary, phenomenal. It's one of my favorites as well. I would recommend it to anyone. And then for the book, on page 93, the author's right, but Sonny was out of his league in the game of the dozens. You ain't so hot, Clay said. I could leave both legs at home and beat you. Sonny was nothing but a big, ugly bear, he shouted as he shifted to a more personal assault. Ugly. I hate him because he's so ugly. I'll murder the bum, he told everyone in the gym. Then he began to climb through the ropes to get closer to the champion. This here to me stands out just in the sense of anti-blackness, calling him a big, ugly bear. And the effect, the psychological trauma that can cause, because I saw a documentary on HBO about Joe Frazier, and Joe Frazier just, till the day he died, he just loathed Muhammad Ali for the things he said about him in public. And in the documentary, he talks about the fact that when Muhammad Ali was blackballed from boxing due to his stance on the Vietnam War, that it was Joe Frazier who literally helped him in a myriad of ways as far as getting out of tax trouble and just being able to take care of his family, because he had no income at that time. And one thing that came up in the documentary is also very good. I'm trying to remember the name of it. I'll try and find it. But essentially what stood out to me in the documentary, because his brother was interviewed, and his brother actually called Joe Frazier's answer machine. And on the answer machine, he's literally like disrespecting Muhammad Ali. So every time you call, you're hearing him disrespect Muhammad Ali. That's how visceral his rage was and his pain from the public lambasting that Muhammad Ali gave him. And to me, this stands out, because when we do these things, we don't realize just how much of a deep traumatic psychological effect it has, just because of the system of white supremacy. So you're getting it from white people, and then you're going to have people who look like you disrespecting you on the same level and using the same tactics that a racist would use to disrespect you for your blackness. So I just wanted to put that out there just as a standout for us to really, really, really think critically before we, you know, speak out of turn to one another. Thank you. And I'll meet my line.
Mm-hmm. Actually, there are many, 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 many documentaries on Muhammad Ali. I think I know of at least two that deal with that. The name calling of Joe Frazier, one of them is One Nation Divisible, where that's a big theme of it, all the names that Muhammad Ali called Joe Frazier and the racist aspect of it. And then it comes up again in a different one that is just on the fight, the Thriller in Manila, which was the third time that they fought, where the name calling comes up again because he was calling Joe Frazier a gorilla, gorilla in Manila, blah, blah, blah. And it just went on and on from there. But yeah, it's a lot there. That is a big theme that continues, probably is going to continue throughout the book and unfortunately throughout the fight career of Muhammad Ali, name-calling and anti-black name-calling of other black people, unfortunately. But that is one of the reasons we're reading this book, so that we do not make the same mistake and just, again, encourage, emphasize the monumental importance of not name-calling other black people. Just that alone, if you can commit to that and model that so that other black people that you're around, your family members, your children, black friends, black people that you work with on the job, see that you are consistent and committed to that. I am not even black people. If, you know, I don't particularly I don't enjoy this person's company or what have you, I'm still not going to name call them. They might not be my best friend per se, but I'm not going to call names. I'm not going to participate in that. I'm not going to engage in laughing and what have you if somebody else is doing it. Might even, depending on the circumstances, make it known that that's not something that I encourage and would hope that we can get away from. One of the big takeaways I hope we get from this book. With that, we will wrap things up. We will be here next Friday, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, for section number 4. Again, we're kind of at the end of chapter 6, and we are a bit more than a third of the way through the book. If you have commentary you would like to share, if you listen to the archives, you want to write in, feel free. UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. We will be here tomorrow. Compensatory call in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll look forward to hearing observations. Another full week on the plantation. Lots to discuss. I will again say, I know it is super warm, so I'm sure folks are going out frolicking, going to the beach, or whatever you're doing in the summer weather. Certainly do not lax in your codification. You do not want to be intoxicated as you are running to and fro in the summer fun. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. If you are going to be in an automobile, you do not want to be under the influence of anything and be stopped by Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, any of their gun-toting comrades with or without a badge. It is one of the worst predicaments you can find yourself in. Let's make sure that we are sober, clear-thinking, so we can make excellent decisions to keep ourselves as safe as possible, you and anybody that you might be responsible for. Buckle up every time you are in the vehicle. Let's do all we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. With that, we'll wrap things up. Thanks everybody for tuning in. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. A victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.